This is side two of tape six of the continuing oral history interview with Martha Taylor. Today is June 22nd, 2006. So, Martha, we were at the Madison Club and you were having one of your early focus groups with women and what their interests were in philanthropy.
Yes. And what was interesting about these focus groups was we had asked them at the beginning of the interview if they were interested in supporting women's issues, and they said no. And then at the end, you know, at the end of the hour and a half, we asked them what were they interested in, and bam, 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 down the line, they outlined specific interests that we would, you'd stereotypically identify as women's issues. Mm-hmm. That is education, childcare, you know, social service issues, breast cancer, all the kinds of issues that you would stereotypically say women are very interested in. Mm-hmm. So I think that really taught us an early lesson that we included in our books and writings and workshops later on that said, you can't stereotype any person's philanthropy based on their gender or their race. You always have to talk to the person and say, what are you interested in? But it is true with women, they are going to be interested in certain things. Maybe. You can't take it for granted. But you always have to ask the person what they are interested in. Mm-hmm. And you have to draw it out from them. So I think from that early experience, and it was just so ironic that we repeated that again and again and again. And later on in our book, we interviewed 150 women philanthropists. And we did the same exact thing and asked the same exact question. And the same exact results happened. So that was really one of the early principles, is drawing out from women what were the important issues they cared about. And we developed, over the time, some very carefully crafted questions on that that have become kind of, core curriculum then that have gradually been used all around the country, and core questions, and been used by many people, I hope, to help people, guiding them in their philanthropy. And just to make the leap in time, because so the listener will have that leap, I think those questions have evolved into, you ask the person, what are the needs of society that you care most about? Mm-hmm. What are the challenges of society that you are most concerned with? And you can do that with an individual, and you can do that in a group setting. And so that was kind of the impetus for a lot of the seminars. And then you go through an exercise, either individually or in a group setting, in ranking those priorities with the person by having them literally give away $1 million or $10 million, depending on the group, to meet those particular challenges meeting society. And I think that process helped people focus on their giving. So it was really those basic early focus groups and that mystery as to, well, if the women didn't, self-identify these issues, how do you help the women identify their passion? And I think that was the other thing we saw in those early focus groups, is that the women were very frustrated because they felt that all the nonprofits were just coming at them with requests, and they really didn't know how to fund things properly. I don't think they were giving to their potential because they didn't know how to prioritize their giving. They didn't know how to say no. They were scattering their giving. They were giving a lot of smaller gifts to a lot of different organizations just because they wanted to be nice. And so we made jokes about, later on in seminars about, how it is when you were younger, you didn't want to, say no to that nice fellow that you saw that sat next to in class you liked him, but you really didn't want to go out with him. So you made the excuse that you were washing your hair on Friday night. But, you know, to go out on a date. But when he called to ask you out on a date, and you said you were washing your hair. But you do have to say, no, I don't want to go out on a date with you. And it's kind of like that with a nonprofit, is you just say no. And instead, you need to prioritize your giving. And so we started to use words and these funny stories too that women could relate to and be comfortable with in a women's only setting, mm-hmm. to explain the philanthropic process. And all of that really started with those early focus groups that Sandra and I did.
Martha, may I ask you, did you notice early on if there were a qualitative difference in terms of interest between the very rich women and the well-off women? Or are your observations about women philanthropists across income levels?
Oh, I think they were definitely across income levels.
Uh-huh.
And I think, sometimes there were, I think, generational age differences, but they weren't that much. Mm. They were slight. Yes, some wealthier families had better education on philanthropy, just because the inherited families maybe had really concentrated if they had a family foundation. But I think the shocking thing to me was, as time went by, that some wealthy families, even in this state, that were, I mean, the wealthiest families, when they heard I was doing this research, would come up to me and really ask me some very basic questions and also ask to have lunch with me. I mean, these are people who had no relationship to the University of Wisconsin. And that was very much a shock to me. And I think the other thing was that I had thought the women's colleges had all the answers, and they didn't. They were looking for answers as well. And so we were all in this together, even though they had been working with women as well. So we were all in this together in looking at women as constituency. Of course, Wellesley had done wonderful, had this new campaign. We learned a lot from Wellesley. But I think the whole movement was just kind of taking off. But let me return to kind of the chronology of events that happened and how really Sandra and I were swept into it and became leaders nationally in it, and how Wisconsin played such a major role in leading the movement, and the University of Wisconsin Foundation and the university played a major role in forwarding the women's philanthropy movement, in particular in higher education, but in affecting everyone. Mm-hmm. And I like to look at it as we did in kind of where K. Clarenbach, we had now kind of the National Organization for Women was housed here at the university early on, and we hatched it here, and it was found an early home, and then it went on and did great things. But, mm-hmm. you know, it was here, and it was an outreach. It was nurtured here. And there are a lot of things like that that the great University of Wisconsin did. And has done and is doing for society that kind of go unnoticed and under the radar screen. And this is one of them that, you know, people really don't know, and our legislators don't know, that this is something the university does. The university nurtures intellectual growth in society, but also public service. And this was a public service outreach component of something good for society that had just kind of come up and sprung up from it is an educational component of something that needed to be done out in the world. So What happened was the Women's Philanthropy Council, what we started to do then, it was a program of the UW Foundation. And that time, really, and always, Sandy Wilcox really questioned why it was needed, why we needed a separate program for women. And as I mentioned earlier, in a way, that kind of fueled us to say, you know, that made us try harder. I think with the former president of the foundation, Bob Brennerbaum, he would have accepted it. Maybe we wouldn't have worked so hard. So
interesting.
But on the other hand, maybe Bob would have given us more staff to carry it out, too. So I don't know. But in any case, and I do have to say, even though Sandy, it annoyed him and made him mad, he never shut it down, which he could have. So, and there were strong women behind it, but he never has understood it, but he knows it does bring in money. So, it's a mysterious thing to him. And, so that's just the way it is. What we did was we had some powerful women in the core group of the Women's Philanthropy Council. We had, of course, the sole woman who was a powerful leader on the foundation, Jean Manchester Biddick, who was really the founding volunteer leader. I was mm-hmm. the founding staff member. And then we picked only six women. All you need is good six people to found a group. And key people, donors, and leaders. So politically, we had the right people as the founders.
Mm-hmm.
And I always tell people that that's what you need to do. And then going on from that, we added people both in name. We had some people who were named, Natasha Morgridge, who's out in California, and Virginia Elliott was out in Washington, D.C., who has since died, and then some other women who were in Florida and so on, major donors, who added their name to it, but who couldn't mm-hmm. be active because of the meetings were in Madison. But then we had a really strong cohort in Madison. Kit Nordine, who had been the athletic director, first women's athletic director, Marjorie Tobias, and Carmen Skilton, and a number of Peg Jones, number of women in Madison. Civic leaders, yes. And, of course, Carol Toussaint was amazing, and Alma Barron. They were, you know, of course, the pillars. Juanita Sorensen as well. So we met, and what we did then is during this campaign period is we met almost monthly during the school year, and we had faculty speak to us about different programs at the university, and we set goals. And at that time, the campaign was still in the mode where, which we've gone away from now, where we were in the mode of the volunteers went out and made calls. Mm. So we actually trained the women to make calls, and we went through women's volunteers making visits to other women. And so we actually were successful. We actually identified women in the community to go visit and, made visits. And the Connies came involved with the university as a result of that.
Marvin Babe Connie?
Marvin Babe Connie, because of the Tobias's. That was a result.
Is that
of
how the Connies got involved?
That's how they got involved. Because Marge Tobias recommended them, and so we went to see them. And the initial gift was Marv giving a Baskin Hill Society membership in honor of Babe for the Women's Council membership.
Huh.
And we had a little dinner at Nakoma Country Club in honor of her, probably her 60th birthday, I would think. And it was very nice, and I know Sandy kind of wondered why we're making all this big fuss about this gift, but see, it was very important.
Mm-hmm.
And in this, these kinds of relationship building things were very key. And so that was important, and we did do very well with that activity. And then the other thing is, Jean Biddick had an idea, and she wanted us to do an educational program called the Women's Philanthropy Forum. And she wanted us to do it every year, but I didn't know if we could do it every year. But she wanted an educational program on investments and on philanthropy, where we brought in outside speakers from outside of Madison to speak about philanthropy, to inspire the women to give. Hmm. And it was her idea. And so she gave a little bit of money for it. So Jean wanted us to do this. And now that has been going on for, well, 18 years. We've had, I don't know, eight of them now. Every other year, we've had these forums. But the first one, we had Joan Fisher. And she was a friend of Marianne Shaw's. Marianne was the wife of Kenneth Shaw, who was then president of the UW system. And Joan had just finished writing her dissertation on five women philanthropists. Mm-hmm. And she did a wonderful job. It's the historical women philanthropists in the past. She did a wonderful, wonderful job, and she gave a great speech and really was inspirational and talked about how you give small gifts each year and encourage the woman to say, and think of, you know, how many years you're going to live, and then think of how much money that equals, you know, and really ask people to, you know, think of that bigger number. You know, that's the number you're dealing of and dealing with, and starting to think strategically. And then also her message was also thinking about the details of the challenges facing us as a society, of why we are called to be women philanthropists. And Joan was really an inspiration, I think, to all of us, and still is in her work. She's not active in the Women's Philanthropy Circle anymore, but she made a great contribution, and we always credit her. What happened was a very odd thing. We started getting success, and other people started hearing about our success. And
in the country?
In the country. Mm-hmm. And also, this article had been published by Sandra Shaw and me about career women. The success in reaching career women. And, you know, this was kind of a new deal. You know, because this... And then kind of an amazing thing happened. A couple of years before, a young woman named Ann Matthews was a graduate of Wisconsin, and I always treated young women very seriously when they came to the foundation. And they were kind of shuttled my way, too. I don't know if everyone at the foundation treated young women seriously, or women, period.
Uh-huh.
And so phone calls in fact, some women, actually some older women who were handed over to me, complained about that. I mean, I remember one woman, a big philanthropist in Minneapolis, who actually talked to me, could hear me on the phone. She said, you know, I know you're a nice young woman, you know, I'm a major philanthropist, and I really, you know, they've just given me to you because I'm a woman. And it is absolutely true. And I said, you know, I'm afraid, you know, that you're right. She talked about how her daughters had been discriminated against at the university and so on. And that was a story that I learned. And it was interesting, some of the phone calls that I would get from people. But of course, on the other hand, to defend my colleagues, they felt that I would relate to them better.
Mm-hmm.
It was just one of those things. And I think all these lessons taught me that every development officer needs to know how to work with women better and treat them the best way mm-hmm. possible. And what happened was I I had met with Ann Matthews, and I took her seriously. I took her out to lunch. And she was a stringer, a reporter, and she did freelance articles for different magazines on the East Coast. So I got this phone call from her maybe 2 years later, and she said, you know, Martha, I was thinking about what you were talking to me about women's philanthropy, and, you know, you asked me to kind of scout out programs here on the East Coast to see if anybody's doing anything in higher ed. Nobody's doing anything. You know, she was affiliated with the Princeton writing program. And I'm talking to these people at Princeton in high levels, and they really think that what you've been talking about is really needed. And I want to do an article about this program at Wisconsin for the New York Times magazine. And I've talked to them about it. Are you willing to do this? And I'm, well, sure. And so, and then we talked about photos, and she said, well, the important thing is get photos. And I said, do you have any photos? I said, well, not really. She said, well, don't say I told you this, but stage an event. Hold an event right now and I'll get a photographer coming. Okay. So I said, fine. So I picked up the phone and I called Marianne Shaw, and I said, Marianne, here's the scoop. So what we did is we set an event at Brittingham House, and we had Denise Denton, who was she's chancellor at UC Santa Clara. Santa Cruz, sorry. And she was a wonderful professor of mechanical engineering, our first woman. And she had just done, she's wonderful and interesting work in engineering, but we wanted to have, we always had, you know, women faculty members. That's always been something that, you know, Jean said was very important in other women, to have women faculty in order for the women to bond with the faculty and identify with them. And also, the idea is that also it had a lot to do with the advancement of the women faculty as well, to give them the opportunity to do development, because that had something to do with their advancement. Because then when they are applying for deanships and department chairships, they can write down they did development work with the women's program of the UW Foundation. And believe me, in today's environment, you have to have development experience if you're going to be a dean or a provost or president or whatever. And so I that evolved over time, too, is really how important that was. And when we were first starting out, we didn't know how important that was. But with Denise, there she was, and of course she's gone on, now she's a chancellor. But she was our speaker, and she talked about her work, and then she also talked about recruiting women into engineering. And she talked about how you had to have lots of different faces of the women who are the potential recruits for engineering, showing, you know, one in blonde hair, one in, you know, in brunette, and all, you know, one with glasses, one minority, all these different faces. You couldn't just have one picture of a woman. You had to have all different types, you know, because they have different many hairdos. It was with a man, maybe you could just have one man. But with women, they look so different. You had to have that. It was a very interesting thing. And again, we picked that up from her. It's kind of like the American Doll with Pleasant as well. She has that same concept, you see. And we also consulted heavily. Pleasant was very helpful to us. And Jean Biddick and I met with her several times when we were crafting the Women's Philanthropy Council, and how we set it up, what we did, how we marketed it, that kind of thing. Pleasant said the exact same thing.
This is Pleasant Rowland, yes, of the American Girls Doll Company.
Yes, okay. Who went on and was fabulously successful because she was starting the company at about the same time. It was very small, but she said, you know, you have to establish these niches and that each person can identify with. So Denise had that same message, and at any rate, she was our speaker, and then we had this photographer there. And then during lunch, we had our shortened focus groups, because we always had little questions for the women at the at the tables of, you know, we ask them different questions like, what is the most meaningful gift you ever had? And then we have them report out and that kind of thing. We always have discussion, you know. But we had them take pictures, had this reporter take pictures. And then we also had magazine wanted a one-on-one. So I was happened to be meeting with Joyce Bartel about her fund, and I knew Joyce would say that's fine because she's used to the media. Mm-hmm. She's from a media family. And so she consented, and so Joyce, of course, got a picture in the New York Times magazine, too. So
she was thrilled.
She was thrilled with that, yeah. And so we're in the New York Times magazine, and my picture was in there, and the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Foundation.
And the year?
It was 1991, April 1st. Never forget it. And the country was invading Kuwait at the time.
No, we're fine.
And we were invading Kuwait, and so here we were in the New York Times magazine. What happened? Well, that kind of changed my life. In that, right after that, and Anne had warned me, people are going to call from all over the country. And it's kind of like, because I'd mentioned, you know, my duties had changed at the foundation, and then I had become involved, very much involved, too, with, I'd been asked to be on the university club board, and I was busy with that. But this Women's Philanthropy Council and what we were doing, I'd become very much embroiled with that. But then all of a sudden, there was this huge demand for my time from 200 people who called after that New York Times article, like within the next 2 weeks. I mean, we couldn't take the phone calls. I mean, and this is not in the day of email. Uh-huh. So, you know, my assistant is taking these phone calls at the front desk. I mean, I am taking these phone calls, and all these people wanted, you know, me to call them back and talk to them. And this is, you know, development office. This is women philanthropists who would say to me, I have nobody else to talk to about my giving. I just don't trust anybody. Can you help me? I mean, this is scary. I mean, this is like, what? You know, and so I would talk to these people. And, I mean, when you feel this, it's like a real responsibility. And because I, you know, was born, as I explained before, in a family of, you know, brought up in, you know, hearing John F. Kennedy saying, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And then I brought up in a religion that says, what gifts do you have? And what you can bring into the world, you know, mm-hmm. You have a sense of responsibility that you can't just be listening to these people, and you have a responsibility to do something about this. And then also, I knew I had this information that I had done this research on the giving statistics about that, you know, these myths about women's giving were wrong, and that there were potential real hazards about women not being admitted to higher education because of them, and what other decisions in society that were negative to about women and other things were being made. What decisions about things that were being funded were being made because of this. Let alone the, you know, fairness issue. And I just looked at the loss of the potential to society, period. And also, I think, you know, when you're raised in a family and in a university with the Wisconsin idea, mm-hmm. We're really of service to society. You are called to action. Mm-hmm. So I had my good friend Sandra Shaw, and Sandra and I had been developing a very good friendship, and we had been meeting quite a bit and talking about these issues. And
Was Sandra still with the State Historical Society?
Yes.
Is that where she was?
Yes. Okay. And she was there, and we met all the time throughout this time to talk about these issues. And, you know, we would be talking about the Women's Philanthropy Council and all these things as I developed them. And then we... what happened was, that was in April. But then in November, it was just bothering me because people were still calling me. And then I was asked that December, that it was coming December, to speak at CASE, was coming up, to speak at the Council for Advancement and Support of Education on Women's Philanthropy that December. And in November, it was really bothering me because there were still all these people and I hadn't gotten back to them. And there's, you know, what should I do? What should I do? So it was really bothering me. So I got up in the middle of the night and I just started to write a newsletter. And I decided, I thought, I'm just going to call this the National Network for Women as Philanthropists. And I physically wrote this thing in the middle of the night, and I wrote out this thing. And I went to the office the next morning and I called Sandra. And I said, Sandra, this is what I did. I woke up in the middle of the night and I made up this name of this newsletter. And what do you think? We'll just have this thing to be called this organization.
This is tape 7, side 1 of the ongoing interview with Martha Taylor, Vice President of the University of Wisconsin Foundation, June 22nd, 2006. You're up in the middle of the night.
Martha. Yes, yes, I know. And it was one of many times I was up in the middle of the night.
Not the first or the last, but a major.
A major one, yeah, yeah. And so it was great because I knew that this was something that, knowing from past things, you can't do something like this without a friend and someone who was committed, and especially, you know, as a volunteer. And, you know, and it was the time in Sandra's life, too, with that she was very interested in this for a number of different reasons, mm-hmm. Which is her own story. But there's no one as committed to this topic than her. I mean, the two of us are very, very committed to this, and we've really committed the last 20 years of our lives to this topic. And it's been wonderful because we've had a great working relationship, mm-hmm. and friendship. And so, and I think the knowing also too, when you have women and people, and you have co-authors, when you're doing something, you hand things off to people too, you know, when the other person is busy, and mm-hmm. that really paid off. So I wrote this first newsletter, and in it, and we always had fun. You know, we wouldn't have kept this up if we didn't have fun, because mm-hmm. this was an add-on thing to our jobs and our lives and our busy families. And if we didn't have fun, forget it. So our motto is have fun. I mean, we had to make a contribution, but we had to have fun too. So, I mean, we always did things with a little bit of a twinkle in our eye. So one of the things at the bottom of the newsletter we put down, at the bottom of the newsletter, was we wanted to do some workshops, all right? And we had these ones that we had kind of experimented with a little bit. Sandra had come to the ones we had done at the Women's Philanthropy Forum here in mm-hmm. Madison. But we hadn't really done anything outside of my small little group where I had done training sessions. And Alma Barron, who was a wonderful teacher and everything, who had taught me how to do group facilitation and speaking. When I was doing Bascom Hill Society and other things, she had taught me, you know, how to do those things. But I had not done it elsewhere. So at the bottom of the first newsletter, I put, our favorite topics for workshops are, I didn't say we had done them before. I just put our favorite topics.
Are we drifting into the gray realm of truth here?
Yes. No, but it was our favorite topics. Our favorite topics. So I put that at the bottom of the list. Our favorite topics are these subjects, you know, these subjects. And hence I just said, here's our favorite topics. But I never said we had done them or anybody else had done them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, but I sent this out to anybody who had ever read the New York Times and responded or called me or anything. So it was like this list, which, again, thank you, UW Foundation, for having this, letting me keep this mailing list at the UW Foundation. We kept the mailing list for, I don't know, how many years? 2 years, probably, till it went over to the university. And maybe not that long, maybe a year, but it went over to School of Human Ecology, then they took it over. But we kept that list, and my secretary kept it, and because that was an amazing list, with pretty big name philanthropists on it too. So then I went to the CASE conference, and I asked Sandra to go with me, and I did give a big address on women's philanthropy, a session that December, and at the end of that, a couple people came up to me and said, I read your newsletter and I was interested in these topics. And then at the end, and I said, well, you know, we haven't really done that much on them. You know, I had to be truthful. I said, but they're intriguing to us, you know. And then that's when one of the people was from CASE Western Reserve. And she said, well, you know, I really think you have a message, and we want you to come and talk to our trustees. And of course, this was a huge step for me to go and make an address to the trustees. My goodness. Of, you know,
CASE Western Reserve.
CASE Western Reserve. And, you see, to me, what happened is that I had always been the write the speeches for the Irv Shanes and the Bob Rennebaums and all those, our volunteer leaders of Bascom Hill Society and the volunteer leaders of the Women's Philanthropy Council. And I made a few comments, you know, 2 minutes here and there at our meetings or up to 5 minutes on one aspect or something. But to give a keynote address in an evening at an auditorium to the trustees, okay, but this is a leap here. Okay. So I knew something was happening in my life here. And of course, then they also wanted me to do a workshop, for, the development office. And, you know, that's a pretty heavy duty development office. And of course, then also they wanted to pay me. This was new. And what I said was, I will do it for the same price, but I wanted my colleague, Sandra Shaw, to come with me. Because you see, that way Sandra and I will do the keynote, because I had the name of the University of Wisconsin next to my name.
Uh-huh.
Made a big difference. That's all the difference in the world. At that time, it still does, you know, that in the beginning, of course. Even though Sandra could have given the same exact speech as me.
Mm-hmm.
But it was because I had the name of University of Wisconsin and she had State Historical Society. Mm-hmm. And at the university to university, that was the credibility factor. But in terms of the development workshop, then we did it together. And I remember putting that together with Sandra. That was one of those late night things, and we still had overheads at that point. And,
mm-hmm.
and the questions, that was, I think, one of the toughest ones. We had some tough workshops in the beginning because, you know, they questioned the whole premise of it and that kind of thing. But then there, we had some meetings nationally, but it went over very well.
Talk about it a little bit, Martha. This is your first appearance as a national figure.
It was my first appearance as a national figure. And then what we had decided to do by that time, too, was we were going to write something. And so when we went to different cities to speak, we started to interview major philanthropist in the area, so we kind of did research. And we interviewed this Lindsay Morgenthaler, a philanthropist, and we got a great quote from her. I still use this at the end of a lot of speeches. I was there. I was involved. I made a difference. I love that quote.
Mm-hmm.
And but that was right from Cleveland. And also the first speech. So I always use that in my speeches now. It's kind of sentimental. But it was a wonderful, it went over very well.
And were you challenged much by the trustees?
No, not at all by the trustees. And with the trustees, there was a lot of old money. And if you have old money, they accept women philanthropists. That was one of the things that was very interesting to me. Of course, because a lot of the women in the families had been the keepers of the philanthropy
mm-hmm.
over the generations, and the wealthy, the very wealthy families, the women had managed the philanthropy, and it was very accepting. That was very interesting, and it was more the development officers.
Yeah. Mostly men.
A lot of women, too. They didn't accept it either. Some of the women, we had problems with the women, too. Yeah, no doubt. But, everyone had been trained in the whole model of raising money from white businessmen, mm-hmm. basically. And also civics, you know, based on the old civic givers based on loyalty and tradition. And, you know, that type of giver, even though they were probably the easiest to raise money from, they're gone. They're leaving, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's raising money from entrepreneur. And so both, you know, the baby boomer men and women, it's based on a whole different set of motivations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why we always used to say that women philanthropy is leading the forefront of the changes of all philanthropy, because it was. What we were saying is, this is what you're going to have to be doing with all of your donors. And we were right. This is what we've been shown. And, of course, that was, in the beginning, you know, we were very nervous about it, but that's what the research has really shown, is that the baby boomer men are more similar to the women of all ages than to the older men. Yeah, so I think, you know, in now we can sit back and feel good about it. But, of course, then it was controversial and not accepted.
And it was not accepted or endorsed particularly at the UW Foundation, was it?
Oh, Martha? No, not at all.
I mean, I think that's important for you to talk about. I mean,
no.
You've alluded to it.
No, it was not. I think, of course, I had supporters. Otherwise, it wouldn't have continued.
Uh-huh.
I had supporters within my colleagues, too. I mean, certain people, you know, obviously, Walt Keough, Marion Brown, were supporters of it. And within the university, I had supporters. Definitely. The women deans, Virginia Henshaw, Robin Doffitt, who's later a dean, and John Wiley was certainly a supporter. David Ward, you know, the university people mm-hmm. definitely supported it. But Sandy did not support it. He never understood it. But because of the women who were on the committee, we couldn't get rid of it. And now the council has done very well. And I think he's pleased with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think now it's helped a great deal. And I'm skipping ahead, but with our own situation at Wisconsin. But you see that I did get very burned out on doing the national scene and Wisconsin, and I did get very burned out. I couldn't keep it up. It was just completely crazy to do so much.
Mm-hmm.
And my colleague Lori Rapay became interested in it, and ever since Lori took over doing the council day-to-day and I took over the working with the council members and their giving, then we were showing real results, you see, because I never could work with them so much on their giving or doing the follow-up to what we were doing, because you can't do both the running of the administration and the newsletter and the events and that kind of thing and the follow-up on their gifts.
Right.
So we've been a great team together,
mm-hmm.
Because now you have the bottom line of the person following up to talk to the people about their gifts and me and Lori getting the infrastructure done, the committees, the newsletter, this kind of thing. And so, and we have a wonderful chair at the moment, and we will continue to have good chairs. And it's always good to have more staff people and colleagues. And I do think it's very good for programs around the country, and I always recommend that, is to have two people devoted to it half-time. You know, if you can, or part-time, not have one person. You get too isolated because it's, you know, among certain people, it's too controversial. You get marginalized. And what the goal of it is to get the program to be a part of the regular development process for every single person on the staff, to be more sensitive to women and minorities. I think the other key thing that we did politically within the office is that in about the last 5 years, well, 3 years, is I really went out of my way, and we went out of our way, Miriam Brown and Ed Manuel, the African American group,
mm-hmm.
and the gay and lesbian group, to mm-hmm. unite. I mean, because you just can't touch us when you do that. And so I always recommend people to do that. Really.
Yeah,
and these are
very
legitimate,
smart.
Legitimate niches
yeah.
for offices. I mean, talk about, you know, gay and lesbians. They have a lot of money.
You bet.
And especially if they don't have any kids, for heaven's sake. I mean, this is a gold mine for development offices, and they overlook these people. And we need to be talking to these people about their giving, and we're not. So I just think we have to work on this. African Americans, we need to be working on this. And so I think, you know, this is where you get your colleagues together around, you know, this whole issue of the niche, you know, and you unite, and nothing they can do about it. So I think that's a real story. And I think the main thing is you can't doubt yourself. I think in the beginning I was just so worried and doubting myself, and is this for real? But of course, in the beginning, everything, it was so untested, and we really didn't know. And now, it's like when my grandfather wrote the initial book on chemical engineering. I mean, and people in the industry go to his book, you know, when they are setting up the factory, to look at his formula to set up the factory. Well, now people have our books on women's philanthropy to set up their programs. And they say, this is the way it is, so this is what we will do. They have the confidence of that history. And then the other programs that are being set up now may say, well, it's not exactly that way now. Let's fix it up and make it a little bit better. And so they build on what we did and make it better or change things. So we're building and improving the profession and the field of women's philanthropy, especially in higher ed, to make it better. But when we started, it was like there was nothing out there for women's philanthropy in co-ed institutions at all, nothing. There were friends groups that were kind of marginalized, like women being little friends groups doing volunteer.
Uh-huh.
There were wonderful programs, especially at Wellesley, in women's colleges. But other women's colleges were really struggling with the whole issue, like Alverno, women's philanthropy. And I consulted with Alverno as a volunteer. And Sister Joelle Reed was on the board later of Women's Philanthropy Institute. But they would often ask men to be on their boards. They just didn't know what to do about how to change the mindset of women. So I think I should go on from, so how did we take this these issues in 1991 when we got in the New York Times and we spoke at Case Western, and what happened from there, and how did we develop it? Well, We had this organization, National Network for Women as Philanthropists, and we were talking with Jean Biddick, Women's Philanthropy Council, and Kay Vaughn also, and they really were big supporters of the School of Human Ecology. And they talked to the dean there, Ham McCubbin, and Ann Thompson, the associate dean, and they said, you know, we really should have something on women's philanthropy in this school. And so we knew that this, whatever we were doing, couldn't exist, this mailing list and this newsletter couldn't exist at a foundation forever. But we were thinking about, should it go for a nonprofit or should it go to the school? What should happen to it? Okay. Then at the same time, McCubbin and Thompson were thinking, well, we should have a conference on this subject. I mean, they knew it was a big thing, and they were talking to us about that. So the bottom line, to skip 80,000 meetings, we were able to get a Wingspread conference at the Johnson Wax, the Johnson facility, beautiful Frank Lloyd Wright facility. And this was kind of a seminal event for women's philanthropy. And we structured it so that it would be bringing together these different bodies of groups from women's philanthropy, because we were kind of the new kids on the block. It was the women from the Women's Funds. Now, the Women's Funds had started in San Francisco in 1975. 79 they had started. Now there's about 200 in the country, but the first one was founded by Tracy Gehry in 1979. And Women in Corporate Foundation Philanthropy, that was founded in 1977. That was women who were like officers in corporations and foundation philanthropies, and what they wanted was more money for women and girls. So the early women's philanthropy folks, those women were all focusing on getting more money for women and girls only. Okay, so you had, then in 1985, you had Women's Funding Network. And that was an organization that was founded to kind of take the kind of all the women's funds and make a network out of it. So then you see in 88, our Women's Philanthropy Council was founded as our group was the first group within a major co-ed institution to really focus on major gifts from women to anything at the university. We weren't, you know, the friends of the library or something. Because there were, a group, like at Northwestern, of women that had lectures for women. There are more groups, like, within alumni associations at different universities around the country, traditionally. But they were, either they would do little fundraising things, little projects. But this, our group was the first one to focus on large gifts. And we asked people to join the Baskin Hill Society level. So it would be, you know, $10,000 gifts. So that was kind of a big deal, to be focusing just on that. And, you know, this is, of course, what everyone in development wanted to focus on. How do we get women to focus on large gifts? Because everyone had the same problem. No women on their boards. Same problem as we had. So then UCLA followed about 1990, and then there was the Cornell President's Council for Women and a number of different groups. Then the 1991 New York Times article. And then in that same year, National Network of Women as Philanthropists. So that's kind of the progression. But those other groups were out there, and we also had independent sector. There were some women. So we decided to have this conference with these kind of different groups that had never talked to each other and get them together to say, what should be the agenda in this country for women's philanthropy? And it really was a terrific conference, and we got everybody in the room together.
Oh, you did. You were successful in getting all these groups together.
Yeah, And it was wonderful. Of course, I had little kids at home and still, and, you know, busy. And I was still working 4 days a week and doing this other women's philanthropy on my fourth day and then other activities with the children. But I was thrilled that we were able to convince McCubbin and Thompson to have Sondra to be the chair of the conference, because that was key. Instead of, you know, having a faculty member who knew nothing about the topic.
Uh-huh.
Because really, there was no faculty member in SOHI who knew anything about the topic at that time. I mean, maybe they had read something, but the person who I would have wanted to have chair it, I didn't know at that time, Robin Dothit, but later I found out about her, but she and the dean didn't get along, and of course I had utmost confidence in Robin, and Robin later became the dean, which I'm thrilled about, but that was too bad. But and later Robin did become the Vaughan professor in women's philanthropy, so I was glad about that before she came dean, because she was very interested in women's voluntary leadership. But she was too strong of a woman for McCubbin.
Interesting.
She couldn't control her. I mean, she was too strong. So she's a wonderful leader, Robin Dothit. And I'm trying to always help her as much as I can in her work to establish a nonprofit center here and do different things. So, in any case, we had the Wing Spread Conference, and at that conference was the first time I met some of these really heady, wonderful people, and also I was able to invite some people and meet some people, Kim Otis, who I've remained in touch with, who was is a Wisconsin graduate and was working with the Hunt Foundation at that time, and then she became head of the Women in Corporate Foundation Philanthropy and actually spoke at our Women's Philanthropy Forum last fall. And Kate Muther is another person who Tasha Mortgage had introduced me to, and I was able to invite her to that conference. There are other people we couldn't invite because the Johnson Foundation had given us a strict formula. It's once we set out with our outline and said this is kind of the proposal, they really wanted us to stick to that, and that we had limited to only a certain number of nonprofit leaders. They wanted a certain number of philanthropists and a certain number of people from other places other than development officers. See, they didn't want it to be just a development officer thing. And so we had to not invite some development people, and some of these development people were very upset with us. And that that unfortunately left a bad taste in some people's mouth for a while, and a long time. And that always stayed with us for a long time, forever. And it was kind of out of our control, but it, you know, it was, maybe we didn't handle it well to begin with, because in the beginning we were just saying, oh, this is Wingspread, it's so great, but not everybody could be invited. And it was unfortunate. But it was, it just had to be picked on geographic and that kind of thing. But it was a wonderful conference, and Andrea Kaminsky was there to report on it from the School of Human Ecology, and she became very excited about it. She was the newsletter editor at that time. And then what happened as a result, we were sitting there at the end of the meeting, and Hannah McCubbin then offered to take over the writing of the newsletter of the National Network for Women's Philanthropists and have it to be housed in the school. So we said okay at the end of that conference.
And this is in 1992?
Yeah,
okay.
1992. So that's what we did. And so then it was in the school for 5 years. And the reason also, how could I forget this? Before Wingspread, that was in the fall of 92, in the spring, Mother's Day, we knew we couldn't have an organization unless we had some money. And both of us, because we were from Wisconsin, we felt it was really conflict of interest to really ask anybody from Wisconsin. We felt we didn't want anybody to, you know, say we were, you know, have conflict of interest. So we wanted to find somebody who had no relationship with Wisconsin who would really be committed to what we were talking about. And what we were talking about was having an organization who would communicate to all women philanthropists and professionals working with women philanthropists who would really talk about the principles of this development as a relationship building, you know, not this sales way, relationship building and this educational, working on education with women about trying to help them find their passion in their giving so they could be more strategic in both their volunteer time and giving away their money, and also working with them to try to overcome all of these barriers about philanthropy in terms of, you know, is it their money, giving out of their checkbook versus their assets, you know, all the number of barriers that they may have held, you know, money barriers. Also, things about, you know, being more, finding more joy in their giving. And so, because by that time, you know, we still had, we're experimenting with these programs, but we had had some real successes with the programs. And I do need to add at this juncture that I guess it was about that time that Cheryl Altenkemer at Purdue had asked me to come down. It could have been later, and I should know the date, but I had, I'll tell the story now at any rate, had come down to Purdue to give a talk, and because we kind of had met, by that time we had been meeting with all the different people in the Big Ten and so on. And I had given my little needs of society talk about here are the needs of society, I mentioned this earlier, and giving away the $1 million. Well, someone in the session came up to me at the coffee break and she said, you know, I'm going to really give away the $1 million to the project I talked about.
But I think we lost a little bit of that. This is side two of tape 7, Martha Taylor, 2006. So you're at Purdue, and this woman came up and said she was actually going to give $1 million.
Yeah, and so she said, I'm going to give this $1 million I talked about in the exercise that I had just gone through with her in this group setting. And I asked her, and she said, I said, why? And she said, because you gave me permission to follow my heart. And I don't think it was me. It was the whole group, and it was the discussion, and it was the process. You see, it was the process. So it was the freedom to think outside of, you know, the day-to-day. So it was a very uplifting moment to
I would say.
It was like crashing down, a lightning bolt was crashing down to me and saying, you should be doing this, you know, this is your calling, and this is important. And my friend Cheryl Altenkemer also developed a wonderful exercise then afterwards that we used later that we actually sat with the women and worked on developing needs, developing, pooling money to meet projects, meet project needs at the university and so on. But so we had had these life-changing educational experiences that, you know, both Sandra and I had spoken to different groups, and Sandra had equal stories. But I think Lorraine Burkhart's story was one that really affected everybody. And, of course, that story really got around. You can bet. Somebody giving $1 million in a seminar. Oh, boy. Let's get this woman here to talk to her donors. But the process, you know, and that this really worked. And Cheryl Altenheimer, Purdue, Martha Taylor, Sandra Shaw, and then the Center on Philanthropy was there. And those people in Indiana. And, of course, I had begun conversations with Jean Temple around that time about this, and that really they should be doing something in donor education. So we had this, and we wanted to institutionalize this. Okay, we need money. Okay, this is before the Links Rights. So Sandra was at all things home of maleism, Rotary, downtown Rotary in Madison, and she was sitting next to someone. Charlie Stathis, a wonderful person, his daughter Lynn is in a Fund for Women in Madison, I know her. Lawyer at UW System, and she was talking about this, and he said, have you ever heard of Maddie Lovett? She's in Iowa, and she's heading the Drake University campaign. I've just read about her. Sandra comes back to me. We used to have these exciting phone calls. Now we have exciting emails. Blah, 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 da, da, da. Heard about this woman, blah, blah, blah. Well, let's call her up and let's drive down to see her. And, you know, this was on a Wednesday, and then the next two weekends was Mother's Day. So Sandra and I, we were always just so gutsy because we would, you know, see the name of, like, whatever big philanthropist here and there. We would find their phone number. We'd call them on the phone. I mean, we did that for our book. We did that for our interviews. Mm-hmm. But that's what you have to do.
Of course.
And we weren't asking them for money. I mean, in this case, we were. But we were asking them for usually their advice or their interviews or blah, 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 blah. But with Maddie, we wanted to, you know, we would have interviewed her. But we thought, we want to make a new friend, and maybe she would be interested in funding this. Because we had just heard about her. And so Sandra picks up the phone and calls Maddie. And they just hit it off so well on the phone. And at any rate, she gets an invitation to come down and visit her the following weekend. It was Mother's Day in 1992. So Sandra and I drive down to Des Moines, Iowa. And Mother's Day, spent the weekend with Maddie. We had a blast. We had so much fun. We met Jack Oley, who was head of development there, and we've remained friends with him. And he's now president of Waldorf University. And then we go out to dinner with Maddie and just tell her about our dream, and we asked her for $100,000 to fund this and be this benefactor with us to create this dream, and here it is. And of course, Maddie wanted all this information, so and so on. And so, but the bottom line is, you know, she came to Inkspread. She, over all this time, she did it. She funded it. And she's been a friend ever since then. And we just had fun. I mean, and Maddie was a fun person. I mean, she could tell that we were fun, that we wanted to have fun with this. And Maddie is a fun person. I mean, she had fun in philanthropy. That was one of her mottos. And so we just hit it off so well. And so Maddie was at Wingspread. See, that was part of, I think, the important thing. She wanted to know, was this going to work? What kind of people? That kind of thing. And so she said afterwards that she would do this. So we were all there, you know, with this and decided to go have this at the school. So we have this money, this seed money for Maddie, to then have the staff person, meaning Andrea. So Andrea Kaminsky was the actual staff person, and we had a little office in the fourth floor of SOHI, and Andrea just was the hardest worker and the most incredible person, and fielded all these phone calls. It was about 5 years we worked there. And then it just, we had an advisory committee and so on, but we did a number of things nationally, and at that point we were really building the national credibility for women's philanthropy, and mm-hmm. one of the things we really set out to do was get media attention. So, we had wonderful working relationships with a lot of media people. Holly Hall of the Chronicle of Philanthropy, who still covers the beat of women's philanthropy today. Hmm. And we just sent her our latest book. And these different reporters, Glamour Magazine was very helpful. They have a good editorial staff. Town and Country, the Christian Science Monitor. And we would also place things, call them. You know, I called the Christian Science Monitor because I kind of knew what they were doing. I was a subscriber. You know, we'd spend a lot of time doing that kind of stuff. Andrea did, Sondra did, and I did. And I did that on my Fridays that I had off. I'd go into the office and I'd use the foundation phones or I'd do it from home. But, you know, we were intent on getting on the national message. Of course, the women's funds were working on getting women's message out too, but we were more on getting kind of more a researchy message on here are the motivations on women's philanthropy, here's why women should give. We weren't as concerned about the message women should give to women alone. Our message was women should give to everything. And I really like kind of the new wording that my new colleague, Lorna Lathrop at the Center on Philanthropy has, which is our message was that Women's Philanthropy Institute, which is the new name for National Network for Women as Philanthropists, is kind of the opening of the door to philanthropy to women. It shows them the possibilities so that it gives them, you know, opens the door to look at all the possibilities of, you know, fund women, higher ed, all these different things. But, you know, if the door is closed, you're not going to go anywhere. You're not going to come in. And so the Women's Philanthropy Institute works to inspire women and motivate them and educate them about philanthropy, period, and the process. And then it's up to each of the individual organizations to talk about the issues. And I think that's a very valuable way of describing the function. Because early on, I think the women's funds didn't really know what we were trying to do versus what they were trying to do. And also then later on, there was the development of women giving circles. But the women giving circles always knew the difference between our organization. Mm-hmm. But so we were there 5 years, and also then we did some experimental conferences that were kind of very, very out of the box, because in higher ed it's like you have your donors and you will never, you know, do anything in cooperation with anyone else. So we said we are having cross university conferences because we believe women are smart. If they are interested in a university, they are going to give to their university, have an educational program together, and give them the education. So we did one on the East Coast and one on the West Coast, and then over the life of WPI, it continues to have regional conferences. But these cross-university ones were early on in our perhaps more ambitious and crazy, foolish stages when we were just taking on the world. But it can be done. We did one with 5 universities in California, and also we had a wonderful, I guess I'd say now, following. I'm not, then I would say, that would be egotistical of me, uh-huh. but now I'd say we did have a following of women who were just dedicated to this subject and would volunteer. Uh-huh. And we had women out there who would work on this. And also, they would organize meetings and get this together, but we had UC Davis. There was a great woman out there. Davis, Mills, Berkeley. There were 5 institutions out in the Bay, San Francisco Bay Area, and it was held at Mills College, and it was a one-day conference that brought together 200 of the top women philanthropists of those 5 institutions. Can you imagine?
I can't imagine.
Can you imagine?
It takes my breath away, actually.
The invitation list was the philanthropist. Now, the development officers could come, but you had to bring two women philanthropists with you. You were not allowed to come on your own. You had to bring two if you came. The audience is the philanthropist, not the development officers. But on the other hand, you see, we didn't say the development officers couldn't come. But we had a big educational problem of teaching development officers that if you come to these conferences, this is not a solicitation process. This is a learning process for you, because part of it was, I really have felt, you know, development officers, you need to learn about the process of philanthropy education too. And development officers still to this day, they're learning about the profession of philanthropic advising much more. I mean, there is a profession of philanthropic advising now, and they actually have conferences and you can get certification, but back then there wasn't. This is part of it. And really, I am a philanthropic advisor, yes, more than a development officer, more than anything. And, we were still in that transition, and I think a lot of the really best development officers and major gift and ultimate gift officers are philanthropic advisors. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know that, you know, Charles Collier, Harvard, and all our faculty officers are philanthropic advisors. But, so at the San Francisco one, they were very good. But the Virginia one, we had some real rookie development officers who, one of them asked some woman for money at the thing. We were just furious. We would ask questions and, you know, in the session, and they were trying to pump answers out of the woman in the one session. And I took the woman aside and said, you know, when you're doing the $1 million questions, mm-hmm, you know, no, you're supposed to be listening. That's your job as a developer. Not, you know, this is listening. Yeah, yes. You know, you're not supposed to be trying to influence. Well, you're not supposed to jump in and say, we have these programs that would follow through on these interests. No, no, no. Okay, so.
Oh, I'm sorry, Martha.
I know. It was sad. So, but it showed us the, yes, the whole way that we need to teach. And it really was very interesting to me. About 2 months ago, there was some new consulting firm that had done corporate training, and they actually came, the foundation hired them, which is very unusual, paid a lot of money to have them here for 2-day training for our staff. And what they did is they came in and basically taught development on the philanthropic advising model as a training. And it was good. It was fine. But you know what? They were very good in training. And I thought, that's fine. That's really good. And I'm glad they're doing it, because they have the right message and they should be out there. And, but all it was the same thing that what we've been doing was the women's philanthropy, what we've been doing for the last 20 years. And so, but it's just a new wrinkle. And, okay. So, we did those two major conferences, a lot of regional, the media. But then I think it was a conversation once when my mother was visiting, Sandra was over, that, we were talking about what we could really accomplish. How could we get this message across? And, you know, my mother said, you know, you're really never going to make a difference unless you write a book. And there had been a book that had been done, printed by the Center on Philanthropy, the Josie Bass series, that we had had a meeting out in San Francisco, and we had passed out an outline of, here's an outline of a book we had thought about. And at that point, the field was so young, and we didn't think anybody would publish our idea, but a couple of the women in the group were able to convince them to do it, and they edited it and got that out. And but there still hadn't been a seminal piece that really talked about the motivations and really studied the field and, you know, set out the vision, you know, a book, a substantial book on women's philanthropy.
Mm-hmm.
And so my mom said, you know, that's what your grandfather had to do, is when he really wanted to set what he, in chemical engineering, you know, they had to write the book. So, Sandra, I went, I guess so. So, okay. So, we went to some conference and we started to talk. Sandra went up and started to talk to some person at the conference. And we always did that. And, talked to different people at conferences and accomplished things. And, so, Josie Bass was interested. And we, Heather Shaw did some preliminary work, her daughter, and Andrea Kaminsky did some work on it. And really was, they were very helpful. And at that point, my son Ben was going into kindergarten, and I had anticipated going to work full-time at that time. But with the book coming on and all these things with the Women's Philanthropy Institute, I just couldn't do it. So I decided that I wasn't going to go back full time. We were going to write the book. We were going to do this WPI stuff. And I also felt, too, as a nonprofit leader and so on, that I really needed to be serving on other boards. So I took on additional responsibilities for the Lutheran Church and State Lutheran Church, Lutheran Campus Ministry Board. I was president of that board. Then I went on the national board for Lutheran Campus Ministry, for Lutheran Campus, for not Lutheran Campus, the Division of Higher Education and Schools for the ELCA, and, you know, Lutheran Social Services in the state. I continued to do a lot of, you know, volunteer leadership, because I felt, too, when I was giving a lot of speeches on philanthropy and talks, that I really needed to be talking the walk and walking the talk.
Mm-hmm.
And so then in addition to that, we were getting paid, and so I also felt you needed to be a leader in your philanthropy, so we were tithing on our philanthropy, sometimes to my husband's dismay, because we're financially trying to bring up these two kids. But I thought it was very important as a statement, as a leader. And then we were also giving part of the money to the WPI, you know, to fund it. So, you know, it was a lot of responsibility. And then I had, of course, my job at the foundation, too, and, you know, and I volunteered at the school. But we worked very, very hard all the time, and Sandra did too. And Sandra had a divorce during that time. I think she was very focused on the book and the work. But, you know, she always says that she would have had a divorce anyways. But, you know, it was tough. We were spending a lot of time on women's philanthropy, and I'm grateful I had a husband who was very patient with it. And I really am.
Did Gary support it philosophically?
Yeah. I mean, he'd make jokes about it. What women's philanthropy, you know, because I was always saying, you know, that women need to make the decisions on philanthropy. And he said, well, you make all the decisions. Don't I get to decide anything? You know, things like that.
Oh.
Stuff like that. Which was just kind of true. Things like that. But, you know, it's kind of funny. But he was very supportive. And my mother was extremely supportive. Because she's a very, very generous philanthropist herself. And, you know, really my role model in that. And also she always managed the finances of our family.
Oh.
And so I always had that role model. My dad really didn't want to have anything to do with that. He just wanted to bring in the money. My mom didn't work outside the home. And she just had that great economic, almost PhD from UW, Madison, and knew how to invest money after working in the Chicago banks and handling the bond portfolio. So she just managed the money. And
good to have one parent like that.
Exactly, exactly. And so we continued on that, but there was a point after a couple of those conferences that we really felt that we could not raise money. There was always a mix-up between my role as a volunteer co-director of WPI, or at that time it was NNWP, at the foundation, and was this organization mm-hmm. there to raise money for the UW-Madison, or was it there as a national thing?
Right.
And all these questions. And plus, we didn't have a board, and I think McCubbin and Thompson wanted control over the board selections. They did not see why we needed, you know, big people from outside. We needed people who would give money and serve and volunteer to be on a board to really take it to the next level. So we, Sandra and I met with Maddie, and we just said, we just don't know if we can continue the way that it is. And the bottom line was we separated to a nonprofit and formed the Women's Philanthropy Institute. And we were the Women's Philanthropy Institute for about 7 years. 5 years we were here in Madison with Andrea Kaminsky being executive director, and then 2 years we were in Michigan with Sarah Spradlin being director. And Andrea did a terrific job. But as I did at some point in, I forget what year, 1990, you know, I got burned out. I was tired and I needed, a rest. Andrea too. It was very hard going. And, mm-hmm. Andrea, went to Meritor for a while, and now she's the head of the Wisconsin Women League of Voters.
Oh, is
so
she?
It's a great job for her. She's such a talented person. She is such a great writer. And, of course, during the time she was executive director, it grew, and we did a lot of things, strategic planning. But I think one of the reasons that I had felt we were in pretty, really, really good shape, we got a major grant from the Atlantic Philanthropies that enabled us to do a lot of good programming for mm-hmm. several years. And then we got an outside board, and that was very helpful. The grant from Atlantic Philanthropies ran out,
when?
Let's see, 2 years ago, 2004. What year are we in? 2004.
Okay.
I think we hadn't been, you know, it was kind of like Busman's Holiday. In that, you know, you don't want to drive when you're a busman on your holiday.
Mm-hmm.
In that, with so many, we had too many people on the board with development background, and so we needed to have more philanthropists on the board, and so we need to develop more donors because we had the big philanthropy grant, and so we had to make that transition. But and so we're working on that now, and but we're very lucky because all along we had kept up a good relationship with the Center on Philanthropy, and all along, you know, Sandra and I had met with Gene Temple at our case meetings and talked to him and urged him to do donor services. And then when he finally got to the point in his tenure as head of the Center on Philanthropy that he was able to look at adding philanthropic services, then he approached, or I don't know who approached who, but Cheryl Altenheimer was president of the board. Cheryl is from Purdue. And Cheryl is a great leader. Talked about WPI merging into the center as part of their new philanthropic services division. And I was very much in favor of this. Mm. I always wanted this to be part of an educational institution. It, you know, of course, being part of a higher ed institution, you know, I know for the long term, this is where you really make change, you know, mm-hmm. is if you're part of a higher ed institution, this is where you really can change things forever. And so to me, that's really the best compliment. And then I, of course, I went down, and I'm still giving speeches, and but I've really cut back now. My goal now is to, and I think Sandra's goal, we still want to give speeches, but is to train the next generation of people to give speeches, to give talks, to give workshops. We have completed now writing, we co-edited a book where we had people write things, but we completed a second book now, and just recently, just was published this April.
Martha, for the record, give us the name of your two books.
Okay, the first book was in 1995, and it was called Reinventing Fundraising, Realizing the Potential of Women's Philanthropy. And this book is called The Transformative Power of Women's Philanthropy.
Good.
Yeah. So we're
remember when your first book came out. I have a personally autographed copy.
Yes.
I do.
Yeah. It was a very exciting thing. And to have the first book like that, first big book in the field.
And it was well received, as I recall.
Yes, it was very well received, and it got some awards. And of course, we did a lot of speaking when the book came out. That was really when we were on the speaker circuit after 1995, you see, up for, you know, 5 years maybe after that. That's what really fueled that. And we'll be asked to be speaking now, too. But, you know, what I'd like to do is get some younger people trained now to do things. And it's so wonderful now. We've got, you know, we've got adjunct faculty status at the Indiana University, and we're getting new people trained, and, like, there's a new person at Luther College I want to train, and I want this new group of younger people to be able to go out and do this, you know, to really educate and talk to people. And also we want to set up partnerships with the Women's Funds and all these other organizations to keep up this education, because I think it's really, really important. But if you look at it, the United Way has the Women's Initiatives, which is huge, that we influence, because not only did we influence the women's philanthropists themselves, but the development profession. So that I believe the development profession does a better job at relating to women. But now all these nonprofits have all these women's initiatives. The United Way has a national women's initiative that last year raised $60 million through all these women's initiatives. They didn't have that before we started, and they used to come to all of our seminars, you know. And we have one in Madison, for example. And the Women's Funds, you know, that was started before us, but I think we added to their expertise in asking for major gifts. And, you know, I think that helped them, and I continue to hope we work together on that to help them to focus on major gifts. I'm currently serving on the Madison Fund for Women.
Oh.
I think the other thing is women's giving circles. And that was started by the idea in Seattle by Colleen Willoughby, which is one of our famous six C's of women's philanthropy, which is collaborate. Women are wonderful at that. And women's giving circles have taken off all over the country. And Sandra has written a little wonderful handbook on how to create a women's giving circle. And those are in hundreds of cities all over the country, and also within nonprofits. And those, the giving circles were really communicated, again, through a newspaper article or magazine, People Magazine, the initial one, and then another one through Simple Living.
This is Tape 8, Side 1, the ongoing oral history interview with Martha Taylor, Vice President of the University of Wisconsin Foundation. This segment, Tape 6, 7, and 8, are addressing her role in the creation of the entire field of women in philanthropy. Today's date is June 22nd, 2006. Martha.
Good. Well, I think I was talking about some of the overall things that resulted as part of the movement and things that were going on. Of course, there were many women all over the country and men working on these issues. But Women's Philanthropy Institute kind of played a galvanizing role in encouraging these activities. And, and that was our goal. Because we had experienced, you know, at Wisconsin, the Women's Philanthropy Council and Sandra, what she was doing at the State Historical Society, you know, the isolation of trying to do this on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And as with anything, when you find a group working on this, it really helps. And early on, the leaders we found at other institutions, you know, that really made a difference. And some of these leaders were Cheryl Alton-Kemer at Purdue, Deb Engel, then she was at Oklahoma State, now at Iowa State, Maddie Levitt, philanthropist at Drake University. These people were wonderful. Later on, we met Ellen Remmer of the Philanthropic Initiative out of Boston, Jane Justice in Colorado, philanthropist. These women were devoted to really spreading the word about philanthropy and educating people. Mm-hmm. There's Pat Lewis, who was the former president of the National Society of Fundraising Executives, who had always been open to having Sandra and me and others speak at the National Conference of NSFRE and have sessions on women's philanthropy at that conference. That was not true with Case. We had, early on, although I mentioned I was able to get on the docket at Case District 5 the 1 year, it was difficult, almost, it was impossible to get us on the docket at the national case meeting and at other meetings for Case. We, in the beginning, we would have to hold like subgroups. You know, we'd have to put up signs and they'd say this subgroup is meeting over here on women's philanthropy. We would not be on a regular program. And one time we had a little sub meeting. We had Kate Muther, you know, who's a famous philanthropist now, the Three Guineas Fund, you know, come and fly to New York. And we have this little group, not on the program, but just came to do this, to egg us on and help us. Maddie Levitt came from Iowa because we just wanted to make a statement, Case. I mean, Kate did that for us to encourage and make a statement. And at that time, her story is a terrific story, and I need to record it. It was actually John Morgridge, who is a wonderful philanthropist, and Tasha Morgridge. John has a degree from Wisconsin undergrad and graduate degree from Stanford. And Tasha is a degree from here as well. Wonderful philanthropists to both institutions here in Stanford. Well, Tasha had introduced me to Kate. That's how I knew her. And so Kate was the one who early on we were struggling, you know, financially. And she invited me to come out to speak at Stanford. And she was a big prospect for Stanford because Kate was vice president of marketing at Cisco.
Oh, okay.
You know, and Cisco stock by that time was really rocketing up. And, of course, they would do anything for the mortgages and Kate. So, even though they didn't believe in this subject at all, Kate asked them if I would speak and give a session for the development officers And see, then I could add to the docket that I had spoken at Stanford, you see, because I would list, you know, that WPI or any, you know, National Network of Women's Philanthropists had spoken at Stanford, you know. And the further
wonderful.
That, oh, of course.
A great gift.
Of course, it was a great gift. She got me on the docket, but not only that, she paid me $5,000 to do it, which I donated totally, entirely to the organization, because I wanted to make a statement in that too. And so we just were all powerful by this movement, mm-hmm. to say, so that she, because she wanted to make a statement that now you can say you get paid $5,000 a day to do these speeches, Martha. That's Kate. I love Kate. And so I did. I said, well, my usual fee is $5,000, but I'm negotiable. You know, but that's what I did from then on. And of course, we'd negotiate from zero to whatever. But, I mean, a lot of talks we did for free, a lot of talks. But a lot of people, a lot of institutions, though, would try to come up with the money because they were trying to help us keep the organizations going. Mm-hmm. I can think of University of Massachusetts, you know, for example. You know, the women there and that development office, Royster Hedgepath, he was the development officer. He had been in the Big Ten, and he was at Marquette for a while, and he wanted to help us because he believed in what we were doing, and that woman development officer and Royster wanted to help us. So he gave us $5,000, you know, and I can think of different ones, you know, that along the way were financially trying to help us, and we'd go do workshops. So Kate's idea did work. So, but Kate had been wooed by Stanford. And her story that I wanted her to report on at this case meeting in New York was the story of how she wanted to restrict a gift to women at Stanford, to women faculty, I believe it was women scientists or something at Stanford, up-and-coming women faculty scientists. And she was told that she couldn't do that. And then what she did is, and she found some alumni magazine that had this picture in it. And she showed this at the presentation. She had this picture that was totally all men, all these younger men of different ages, and this nice, kindly, older man. And it had this picture of this man, and it said, here's Mr. So-and-so, who had given a scholarship to Stanford over the years to former Boy Scouts. And Kate said, so of course she had marched right in and said, well, hey, I want to, you've done this, I want to do this. So of course, bottom line is, you know, Stanford has a program to encourage women faculty in the sciences. Isn't that a great story?
It's wonderful.
Yes, it's wonderful. So she gave this, and she flew to New York to do this. And, you know, people, but and that wasn't even on the program. So, but later on, Peter Buchanan, he became a believer. He was president of CASE, the new president of CASE. He became a believer in women's philanthropy, and then we were on the docket for the different CASE meetings. But Pat Lewis, on the other hand, she was early believer in women's philanthropy and let us be on the docket for those organizations. So these people, these early on, we'd find these people, Bruce Flessner and Bobby Strand with that consulting firm, they were early supporters. But you'd find these early supporters and they'd help you. But there were other people who just didn't understand. I remember meeting with some leaders in the field, some prominent leaders. One of them we sat down with, and they just started talking about Jackie Robinson, and it's like Jackie Robinson wanted to get into baseball. And we went, huh? I mean, he just thought, you know, just the women wanted to get in the man's game. And we weren't talking about that at all. He didn't get it.
No.
He didn't get it at all. What we were talking about, no, this is a different way of doing business. It was a different way of doing business. It's not, we want to get into your game. It isn't, that isn't what we're talking about. So we had a big education in our profession with the development people. And so we did get this group of people, though, who were strong supporters, philanthropists, and development officers, who both men and women, who wanted to forward this. Then I think the other thing is to look at the controversial issues kind of that occurred even within our own organization, which in our own institution, which was the development of Cabinet 99. And Cabinet 99 was the organization at our Alumni Association. And I had invited Pat Aaliyah, who's an excellent woman leader and outstanding marketing person at the Alumni Association, to come to one of these, at that time, these little subgroups meetings at CASE, because we would, even I think by that time we'd have general sessions, we would still have, we'd get a room. CASE would let us get a little suite, and so that we'd have a big table of maybe enough for 25, we'd advertise, of people who were really intensely interested in the subject. You know, part of it was we were trying to spread the word on this so that people would start programs, because we really felt this had so much potential that people needed to know about it, people wanted to know. I mean, we just wanted to spread the word. And we would hold these meetings. I mean, we were like evangelists. I can't describe it in any other way as I look back on it. I mean, why did we do this? Just because we so strongly believed in it, and we so strongly believed that the way that development officers were doing business was not the right way to reach women, and that it was just, it was not doing the women, it was not helping the women. The women wanted to help the universities, and it was certainly not to the institution's best interest. So, we'd have these little meetings, and I invited Pat to it, and she became all fired up about the potential of the of women. So she went back and decided to start Cabinet 99. Well, one of the controversies, and it happened with, and this was probably 93, 94, the controversies within the field, kind of in development and in Alumni Association, and within women's activity too, is what happened was, of course, that early Cabinet 99 group didn't want to talk about money, didn't want to talk about philanthropy. And part of that was Pat Aaliyah and Patty Mullins, I think, talking to the women. They didn't want to scare them off. But eventually, because they didn't talk about it, it's now no longer really in existence. You know, it's staff run. They still have every other year. The Alumni Association at Wisconsin has a women's program. That was the idea. The Women's Philanthropy Forum would be 1 year, and then the next year, the Alumni Association Cab in 99 would have their women's program that did not talk about philanthropy. And the Alumni Association still has that. They still give out the Cabinet 99 award to an outstanding woman faculty member who have supported women on the campus. But in essence, the cabinet doesn't exist anymore. They have no volunteer group that they staff. And versus the Council on Women's Giving, our council, you know, is 25 women. We have 3-year terms. We have a chair who serves on the foundation board. You know, that's a key thing for us, is the chair of the Women's Philanthropy Council serves on the UW Foundation Board of Directors. That's huge. I mean, it's hard for us because to find someone that will do that, do both things. But, you know, we have a group of volunteers. I mean, in a way, Lori Rapay and I have our own board of visitors. I think one of the things that we've done in the recent years is we've attached ourselves to the Office of Gender and Climate, Diversity and Climate, Verna Sturan in the Provost's office. We've attached ourselves a little bit more to give ourselves more political clout on the campus. So that, and we have a collaborative giving project, which is a small amount of money, but the women going along with the whole national movement of Women's Giving Circle, they just give $1,000 a year, and it's to advanced women on the campus, and that's given to Bernard Duran's office. And that's like giving $1 million on the campus, because the whole budget out of Bernard's office is $10,000 for program money to advance women on the campus, you know. So, I mean, that's huge. I mean, they can do a lot of stuff with that.
Right.
And so it's a nice thing for the women to do, and they get involved. But the idea is that the whole council, the objective of the council, is to give their own major gifts to the area of their own interest at the university. I mean, that is still paramount.
Mm-hmm.
But they wanted to do an extra little project. So that other project has become a nice thing for them to get another way to get involved with the university. But there's involvement and there's activity with the Women's Philanthropy Council. But the Cabinet 99 does not have volunteers anymore involved with it. And it's too bad. And because we need a feeder group for the council. But it would help if, I think if they were talking about money early on and did some money raising, I think that would have helped. But, for example, one of the things when we were writing the book, I wanted to do a chapter in the book. I did a chapter on, this is the first book, The Reinventing Fundraising, Realizing the Potential of Women's Philanthropy. I wanted to do a chapter on Cabinet 99. And Pat, Aaliyah, and Patty Mullins didn't want us to do it. Because they
didn't,
no. Because they felt it wasn't appropriate because Cabinet 99 wasn't about philanthropy.
Okay, that's the issue.
See, that's the issue. And to me, philanthropy, they were giving their time to the university, and they were going to be mentoring people. But to me, that was a huge loss because they could have had a wonderful opportunity for publicity, for the Alumni Association, for Cabinet 99 activity. It could have, you know, being in a book is a wonderful thing for the people in the book, too, because they're interviewed and so on. On the other hand, Fund for Women and Jane Coleman, of course, they were in the book, and Jane's and Fund for Women of Madison's in the book, those founders, and they're still going strong.
Mm-hmm.
But that was an interesting thing to me. The similar thing, though, happened at the Cornell President's Council of Women, is that there was great divide in that group of whether they should do philanthropy or not. That was a group set up really because in a campaign, the chief development officer and a chief volunteer, really, when they had approached the chairman of the campaign, had really said, you know, when you approached us for your major gift, it was wonderful and we're going to make this gift, but, you know, you really ignored my wife during this whole process. And so that was one of the reasons that they founded this group. And they also had a wonderful director of development by that time, a woman, and she said, we need this. So they founded this group, but it was more just we'll get the it didn't have a clear definition of what it was going to do. It didn't have it's going to be philanthropy, major gifts. It was let's just get these important women attached to the university. It was out of the president's office instead of the development office. So, you know, you have that problem, and they were dealing with that. And then another example is now is Connecticut, who's they have something going on with their alumni association and something going on with their foundation, and there's always the same kind of tension. So it's a common thing that happens. But now, if that would happen, I know things have changed so much with the emphasis on philanthropy at the university, there would never be any discussion like that anymore. And, you know, definitely, you know, philanthropy. Ah, yeah. That is definitely a part of the mission of the Wisconsin Alumni Association.
Oh, I see.
There's no question.
There's no question anymore.
No question. Yes. Mm-hmm. That Paula Bonner would definitely say yes, you know. But at then, I think it was more arm's length and that kind of thing. So that's another little story I think is important for this oral history about Cabinet 99 and the history of that. Another story that I think is important for the history and the growth of the Women's Philanthropy Council itself, is the New York group. We had been doing the active activity in Madison, and I think that's when you were coming to the foundation. We looked at what could we do in other areas,
mm-hmm.
and also I looked at. Really, it would be awfully nice if we could have some men, you know, lead the charge. And of course, I thought you would do a great job at this, Bob Lane.
Well, thank you, Martha.
Yeah,
I that's did. A compliment.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, and I entrusted you with this baby of mine in New York, and. You went out and recruited mm-hmm. a wonderful group of women
mm-hmm.
who have become great friends of mine and continue to be good friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And you handpicked the women by their giving record and also personality
mm-hmm.
As leaders. And you interviewed them. You had called on them. You had made many calls and visits out in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we were talking about going to New York, you were enthusiastic as usual and said, I'm just the people. So we worked together to identify these people. And then, of course, Walt Keough wanted to be involved as well. And I think one of the things was, I think Sandy was always, I think the problems we ran into is that Sandy was always trying to watch the budget too much, and in hindsight, I think it'd be better if you and I would have been able to go out there more together,
mm-hmm.
And that I could have gone out more to different things, and in the end, that's what happened, that I had to just take it over. Because
you did.
Yeah. And even to go out to Founders Days or keep up the contacts, but it was a good experiment, and I think one of the things was the problems was hearing the bad news from you about what we could or could not do. They could accept, but they didn't want to hear it from Walt for some reason. You know, like if they were told. They wanted to do way more than kind of the normal foundation
mm-hmm.
cookie cutter approach to what a geographic committee could do. And this didn't surprise me at all because they're a group of women. And, you know, and Jean Biddick, she always used to say, women always just want to, you know, roll up their sleeve and put on the apron, get in the kitchen and do the work. You know, I mean, the typical women's group, they want, even these busy women executives, they wanted, you remember, they wanted to do these mailings, and they wanted us to ship the mailings out, and they were going to hand address them because they were so sick of how slow the foundation mailings were, and they took way too long. I
yeah.
remember that?
Oh, of course.
I mean, it was hilarious. I mean, would a group of men do that? No. No.
It was interesting, Martha. It just supports, they were ready.
Mm-hmm.
All that you and I did, really, and it was
yes.
new to me, but not new to you, but it was, like that woman in Indiana said, we gave them permission. We want you. And they said, here's what we want to do.
We just gave them permission. We really, yeah.
That
exactly.
was really, yeah.
We really didn't do anything. We just said, yes, go do it.
go do it.
Yeah.
And then that's where we ran into problems.
Yes, we did.
Which is always, and this is your interview, not mine, but it is so often the case of the bureaucracy everywhere, but certainly at the foundation, trying to do anything new.
Trying to do anything new. Yes. And I think now, you know, if you know you've got things under the radar screen, if you can do certain things under the radar screen, insofar as not have too big of an event and have a smaller event, and so you don't have to have things on the event system. And now you can do certain things, and then you just know how to get around the system.
Mm-hmm.
And keep your volunteers happy, but still the main issue at hand was, and still, they are still this way in New York. I had dinner with Ruth Brown and Lila Shakur, two of our great leaders and great friends in New York, my great friends, they become great friends. And they still said, Martha, you're still doing it wrong in New York. You should be sending out an invitation to every Wisconsin woman graduate to our events, for every event. And the foundation doesn't do that. And because of the expense, and because normally the response rate, it starts when people get older. But they feel we're missing the boat on the younger alumni. But, you know, I think we've had more success when we do have these smaller events and inviting fewer people, where you do more targeted mailings, sending out a personal letter, and this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been doing a lot more of that lately, so we're reaching people. But this year, maybe we'll send out to the whole list again. Just to make them happy. But they also, but that's what they wanted to do, and I do feel, and I know you agree, we did miss huge amounts of money from everyone in New York. We were totally understaffed in New York during the big rise of the stock market.
Absolutely.
And then the early 90s. It was a real loss to the foundation. We were totally understaffed there. They couldn't believe how blind we were. And we were. It was, I really was amazed that we didn't do anything about it. Why weren't we out there talking to people at that time? I don't know. So, because we didn't react very fast. But now we have, finally, it is amazing to me, though, that it was really the women's group in New York that was screaming so high, so much, about having a geographic representative in New York. They wanted them, you know, to live in New York.
That's right, they did.
Yes. And, but it was then some other men on our board who were saying we needed geographic representatives as well. And finally then, of course, we did go to geographic representatives. They not only, we did have at the foundation for a while split, where you had responsibility during the campaign of part for your constituency, part for a city. But then after the campaign, finally we did go to city responsibilities and geography. So we do have Vinny Suarez in New York now, and he's really good and works with women. And then, but now, then, also after the campaign, I cover the New York women's group. I cover the geographic groups.
So are you out there a lot now with the New York women,
yeah,
Martha?
Yeah, I am.
Good.
So, and it's good. It pays off. And I get them to come to campus, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very important thing, you know, is getting them to come to campus. And working with the ones that have a major gift potential, moving them to bring them back to campus, and
mm-hmm.
keep focusing on that. I mean, you have to do that. And so, you know, I think strategically, and looking at what I was doing also on a national level, and I was talking, of course, I always talk to Sandra about it, is for a while there is a period where I was really, you know, I worked on the Women's Council, got that going, and then was you know, it kind of stagnated, really. It was staying the same because I was working so much at the national level, and also just it was just hard. I got discouraged running into roadblocks here at the foundation. But then Lori Rapate came in, and then we were able to do a lot more at the council. And then I was able, then we got the Women's Philanthropy Institute stabilized. And then, you know, I discussed with Sandra, I said, you know, really the best thing I can do, I think, for women's philanthropy nationally is to work to make, you know, our model, the Women's Philanthropy Council, even more successful to use as a good model. So, you know, that's really what I've been working on, is because that's very important for our model to succeed as the first major gift organization.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel that that's, of course, a contribution to nationally. And I have continued to give talks, but I remember, you know, one year, the year that I really did have to take some time off following you, I did 18 speeches in one year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then...
Major speeches.
Yeah. I mean...
This is side two of tape 8, Martha Taylor, June 22nd, 2006.
So I'm really looking forward to even more success for the Women's Philanthropy Council here at Wisconsin. I think some of the issues we are looking at right now are kind of key, and they're edgy. You know, I'm always pushing the envelope. I think one of the key edgy issues is should we be doing a campaign or initiative to advance women on the campus? And we actually, because of our close working relationship with the provost's office, with Bernice Durant, one of our great women leaders on campus, we have identified all these giving opportunities on campus to advance women, you know, especially related to our Women in Science initiative. And we still have issues on campus related to faculty, advancing women faculty that need to be funded. And so I think as a result of all these meetings and hearing Bernice, and also some experience with staff not knowing that there was a women's leadership fund available for them to steer donors to if they wanted to advance women, you know, because we're kind of underground, you know. We need to raise the visibility, and we need the campus. If the campus is serious about advancing women, the campus needs to tell the foundation, we need you to raise money to advance women.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you know, looking at my probably next 10 years that I'm going to be at the foundation, I thought, what do I want to accomplish? And, you know, I think that's one of them, is either get it resolved, yes or no. Are we going to do this? And so I looked at Bernice being a leader. She's going to be around for only a few more years. Bernice is a good leader. Should she take this on? Of course, John Wiley would take it on. He's only going to be there maybe 2 more years. But I think there's a commitment on the campus to do it. Gary Sandifer would be behind it, Paul Piercy. If they're really serious about it, as there's talk, then let's do it. Let's organize this, the giving opportunities to advance women, and put together a case statement so that we can really present these given opportunities to donors who express interest in these things when we meet with them. Now, whether we would go out and say, we're having a campaign to advance women, I don't think so. I think it'd be more for the Women's Council geographic events when we're going to New York, or now we're under the leadership of Doris Weisberg. Doris says, we want to replicate New York. And she's the new chair. And
oh, is she? From Racine, right?
We're from Racine, and she's from New York, and she's fabulous. She said, my vision as chair is I want to replicate New York around the country. That's what I want to accomplish. and Sandy loves her, so, and wants us to do whatever she wants to do. So this has been wonderful.
Well, Martha, that's a piece of good news.
It's terrific. So it's like, yes. So we've basically had, you know, I've been out in L.A. We had an event in L.A. with Joy Pikus and one of our leaders and with Doris in February. But, I mean, this is on top of everything. So I'm probably increasing my hours this fall now in Ben Wilkes College. But now also we've got a commitment, I think, from Russ House, my colleague in Plan Giving and responsible for GEO, the GEO areas, to have Beth Wells do St. Louis. So I think we're going to add a few staff to help out here. We've got Milwaukee going. Lori's going to do Chicago. We've got a new leader coming out of Chicago. And we're cranking here. And Doris has got some really great ideas on programming. Really great ideas. And so she wants to invite men to a few things. We always invite men, but it's fine. It's really terrific. She wants to have a small gathering. You know, she's one of the founders of the Food Channel in New York. And so she wants to have a little luncheon with a faculty member at the Sub-Zero headquarters in New York and invite some very key prospects with our speaker in New York for fall. And, you know, just some great creative things. So I think we have 10 different regional things planned. You know, I mean, we're doing a lot.
Indeed.
And then we have our annual magazine, which we decide to put all our money in instead of doing these little magazines or newsletters. We put all our budget, it costs, I don't know, $17,000 a year to crank this thing out. Okay. You know, Sandy's supporting that. Where we do it more like a magazine, where there's book reviews and there's interviews. It's not like, here's the news from UW. But it's interviews, and there's actually book reviews in it. And it's a very different approach. It's very creative, and Mary Anderson of our staff has done this. So people actually read it, you know, and keep it. So it's very creative.
That's unusual.
That's unusual. So it's a very nice piece. And then we have the Women's Philanthropy Forum that went really well, and also our communication staff has been very good to us. So we've had wonderful articles like about our forum in the regular publications of the foundation. So things are really on the up and up. We're moving on it. And so I'm very pleased. And so what I have to do, though, is focus on, you know, results and on follow-up with the people. We had a wonderful event. Doris wanted to do follow-up. She's good on follow-up with our forum last fall. We had over 200 women. We're at Monona Terrace and Madison Club. And this year, which is a record, and she wanted to do a follow-up. This spring, where we're going, oh my gosh. We invited that group we had them at Brittingham House, and we had a speaker on Islamic women from the university. She was, you know, very topic, big topic, you know, timely topic. Oh, it was sold out, you know. I mean, that never happens. So it's very, people are clicking and we're keeping up the context. So now we have to follow up with all these people. So I'm very pleased about this and the direction of it and where...
For the record, Martha, I think it's important to note you've mentioned Tasha Morgridge several times, and the record does show that both the Morgridges have been among the most generous benefactors to the university ever. But Tasha has made a huge gift in her own name to the School of Education.
Yes, $30 million, and that was the record gift up until the Morgridges together announced their $50 million gift to the Institute of Discovery just recently.
You ought to talk a little, I mean, you've been working, I know
yes.
A lot of people have been in touch with Morgridges, but you, in Women in Philanthropy, have been in touch with Tasha for a long time.
Yes.
Haven't you?
Yes. Yes, really, it's Don Gray on our staff who knows them the best, but Tasha and I have been in contact with one another on Women's Philanthropy for, I don't know, really since the beginning. And I consider her, you know, really one of my teachers and mentors in this, because she, her attitudes on women's philanthropy are so wonderful. And she, after all, she is a teacher. And it's really interesting. I went out to see her this April to talk to her because we are, she's going to speak for us again. She's spoken at the Forum on Women's Philanthropy before and gave a wonderful talk that we published. And I went to see her this April because we're going to have her, we have a new Women's Executive Leadership Summit within our business school. And for about the last 3 years, we've been agitating that WPC, our Women's Philanthropy Council, had given $4,000 of seed money to get a philanthropy track on it. Of course, Pat Aaliyah runs that, and so I was running and worried about that. But we finally got that on there. They said, okay, and Tasha's going to be the speaker. And so I went, I was out in San Francisco this April to talk to her about her talk, and I have the privilege of introducing her. And so we finished this up, and it was just a privilege to meet with her because she, of course, is at a, you know, the top, she's one of the top philanthropists in the nation, she and John. And she is really educating her her children about mm-hmm. philanthropy. And they are going to the top philanthropy education programs in the country, of which I hear about. And, of course, I am a looking at this field in a trickle-down of making those kinds of programs available to the average person, mm-hmm. you know, and to the average graduate of, you know, a public institution like Wisconsin. And there's these programs run by the you know, the Rockefeller Foundation, and these you pay $10,000, and like Kate Muther, who's friends with them, pay that, and they go through it, and they really, you know, you go through it, a 3-year program, and so on. So they really train people, but these people are really giving away lots of money, and so I learn about these details from Tasha, and I learn about her philosophy. So I came back with an idea of what she was going to be talking about, which is what she's talking about before. But the Women's Executive Leadership Summit is really some of the women's leadership executives, who many of whom are Wisconsin graduates, but many whom are not. They pay a lot of money to come to this, and it's really high-level training in Wisconsin, but they pay a lot of money, you know, $1,200 to come for the 2.5 days. It's an excellent, excellent program. And so I was saying what the goal was and so on. We wanted to inspire them to be philanthropists for themselves and their company and so on. And in use of their time and money, and be strategic. And so she was talking about the ways of that, you know, how she was going to talk about and so on. So I came back and I talked to Pat Aaliyah and these other people involved with it, and about what Tasha was going to say. And then we were talking about what the title of it should be. And then we were going to, maybe it should be something like, determining your strategic philanthropic plan. That's not something I would say, you know, to a business group. And then we have this conference call with Tasha. This is Tasha, the educator. Get on the phone with Tasha. Well, and so we lay this out to her. She said, well, she's so sweet. Well, I have a different idea. And I kind of laid it out. She's so sweet. We go, okay. And she said, I'd like to call my talk The Two-Headed Llama. And we go, okay. She said, well, you know that I'm an educator, and you know those Dr. Seuss books where there's the two-headed llama, and the two heads are always trying, one is trying to go this way and one is trying to go that way. And what my message is that sometimes your volunteerism is going this way and your philanthropy or financial philanthropy is going the other way. And my message is, you have to have the heads going the same way. And what? Brilliant!
It's wonderful.
It's brilliant!
It's really wonderful.
I mean, what a teacher! I mean, and I just thought, Tasha, you are brilliant. I mean, and I said, I mean, do we want anything underneath it? And they're going to work a little. But she said, no, I think she's made the two-headed llama. I mean, people are going to just, what is this all about?
They'll come.
They'll come to hear this two-headed llama. I mean, and I thought, everyone is always going to remember that. They're going to remember that much longer than the strategic philanthropic plan, which is so I am going to, you know, I'm going to say, Tasha, I would really like to use that. I mean, that is so brilliant. But I mean, you see, she is a teacher. I mean, and she practices, she walks the walk, she talks the talk, you know. She practices what she preaches. And she was on the foundation board for a while. And she quit because she was bored to tears. She said, you know, this really isn't, but she didn't say it that way. She said, this really isn't, you know, for me. I think I should really be on the School of Education board because that's really what I'm interested in and that's my expertise. Well, of course, we were dying to have her on the foundation board. I mean, actually, they had asked John to be on the foundation board and he had turned him down. And he said, you should have been asking Tasha. He said that in a nice way. But
really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, really. And, she was on the board for a while. But, of course, I would have loved to have kept her on the board because the thing about the foundation board, it is boring. They do not encourage women or anyone else to speak up. All the business is kind of done offline. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when the time comes for you to say something that's important, it may be every 3 years. However, when the time comes, it's very important for you to be there to say something. And it could make a really big difference. And for you to be there on the offline discussions, it's very important. So, you know, people like Joy Pikus, who's a politician by background, and Doris Weisberg, who's used to being in politics, you know, they understand it and kind of thrive on it. But Tasha, she's an educator, and she went, this is kind of boring. So she served on and off School of Education Board and loved it and made many contributions. I mean, she really keeps up with her field, which is reading, and she knows it. She knows her field of reading. Just a couple of quick stories on a couple of the women in the New York Women's Council. Lorna Wendt, and you introduced me to her, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, I have your new best friend, and you're right.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Lorna has been a wonderful friend. Mm-hmm. And Lorna was in her divorce at that time, but she has gone on to be really a national figure in women's philanthropy and in changing the way America thinks about money, as Fortune magazine rated her in one of the top 10 people in the last century to have an impact on the way we think about money. Mm-hmm. So Lorna has been a great leader. She's now on the Women's Philanthropy Council. She serves on the LNS board and school music board. Mm-hmm. And
you and she are Lutherans in common,
and we're
aren't
Lutherans,
you?
Yes.
And I think that's relevant.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That we share that value base has a big, makes a big difference.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Lorna's incredible person. Another person, Christine Lodewick, is on that Women's Council. And she's a Lutheran as well. And Christine and Lorna knew each other when they were growing up. And Christine had a lot to do with my son actually ending up at the University of Connecticut because...
Oh, really?
Yeah, Christine and I became friends. And when we were going out to look at colleges, she had a graduate degree from University of Connecticut and encouraged us to take Mark to look at Connecticut. And he just fell in love with it. And he had wanted to go to school on the East Coast. And so he went there and he just graduated from there. And he had a wonderful 4 years there. And
great.
Of course, I always felt it was nice that, you know, my friends Christine and Lorna were there nearby in case he needed someone. But they did check in with him, and we had a lovely graduation party for my son at their store's home recently.
I'm glad for you, Martha. How nice.
Yeah. And Christine and Philip have done a wonderful minority scholarship in the School of Education, done great things. Lorna has done a wonderful scholarship in the School of Music Fellowship that actually you worked on. Mm-hmm. We'll continue to work with her on that. And we'll continue to work with her on her gifts.
Mm-hmm.
Another great person I mentioned Ruth Brown before in the New York Committee, one of the real drivers out there, just terrific, now in the trustees of the union. Lila Shakur, a great supporter of women's science.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I have to talk about Linda Stern.
Of course.
Linda had called me, it's 25 years ago, but she's been one of these people early on who'd kind of made an imprint on my brain because I get this phone call out of the blue. This woman says, "Hey, I'm just wondering, how much does it cost to join like your president's club or something?" And I said, "Well, $10,000. She said, "Well, my husband just gave a big gift to MIT and I want to do something at Wisconsin in my own name." I thought, oh my gosh, a woman wants to do this, you know, in her own name. You know. And her name was Linda Stern. And one of my good friends from high school, I'm Jewish, was named Linda Stern. And I said, "Linda Stern, huh?" But it wasn't the same one, obviously. But I just like the name. And I like the way she said this. So she said, "And my daughter is enrolling in the university, Rachel, next fall. And I'd like to come see you." We got chatting. She was just one of those chatty people. Let's get together. So, at any rate, she joined the Baskin Hill Society, and then I saw her and met her when Rachel came to school, and I've just been friends with Linda ever since. And so when we were looking toward, and then when Seth, her son, came to Wisconsin a couple of years later, you know, I saw them again, and then I wasn't in contact with them so much. But when you would have things in New York, I recommended that, you know, invite Linda. In that time, she had a detective agency, so everybody was wondering, what is this person with a detective agency? But her husband had EZM Company, and Howard, of course, wonderful name, Howard Stern. But then, when we were forming the Women's Council activity in New York, I recommended we get Linda involved, and we did. And then what happened as a result of one of the faculty showcases we had in New York was we had a faculty speaker and about aging, because I always was bringing speakers out from the university. You and I would work, Bob. I'm bringing speakers out for the events that were of gift interests of the women on the committee.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were always interested in getting them interested in giving, but we thought that they represented other women. And we thought, well, sure, if they were interested in that, other women would be as well. So Linda was interested in aging issues and helping patients. So we had Carol Riff come out one time, and then we had Linda Green come with her from the law school. And she was in the chancellor's office at that time. And Linda Green told her about Meg Gaines and her newly formed Center for Patient Partnerships. And so Linda and Meg talked to each other, and Linda ended up funding then the Center for Patient Partnerships in the law school, Linda and Howard, and that has been a great, great thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and a great character. So what are the kind of issues that I see facing women's philanthropy? Now, I think some people ask me, should there always be a women's program? I think yes. I don't see it going away. I think it's a way to involve people. It's just another option of involving women with an organization. Some women will want to be involved that way. Some women won't. But it's just another option, another way to reach out your hand to involve someone. You can offer, it's another offering. But I always think that there's going to be a place for it. And you make the women more comfortable. Some people don't have spouses, don't have partners, and that this will be a more comfortable environment for them. They can come, they can feel comfortable. We can control the speakers so that it will be of interest to the women. We can have women speakers. We can have a format that's going to be comfortable for them. So I always think there'll be a place for it. I think another idea is this giving circle concept of offering opportunity for women to pool their money together to do things. That's been popular around the country, and I think that will continue to be popular. It's kind of against the major gift hierarchy that we've learned in development.
Mm-hmm.
And I still think when it comes to making their major gifts, women will want to give to their own choice. But I think to engage women, that the giving circle concept is a wonderful concept, and I advocate it. I think I've seen it to be very successful in a lot of institutions, and really the United Way is using it, and a lot of other groups are using it. So I advocate that. I do think women have different educational issues related to their philanthropy, and so I will continue to work on these special educational programs related to women. I also am a very big proponent on family philanthropy education, because whenever you say family philanthropy education, that always means women will be at the table. Of course, we will always go and involve men and not overlook men. We always should do that. And but a lot of men do, especially in the business sector, respond to hierarchical competitive models.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they've been brought up in the business world. But other men in other sectors, in letters and science and other backgrounds, don't respond to that. And I think that the women's philanthropy model offers a lot. It's the relationships building. And in the ultimate way, it's the Bob Rinnabon model, which is the relationship building, the old-fashioned, sit down and have a conversation with somebody about their values, what they believe in, and what they dream about for a better world. That's what the women's philanthropy model is. It's not the hierarchical. What did someone else give? What the competition? What's your obligation? But it's really trying to reach someone and talk about what they really want to accomplish with their money, how they've spent their life. And that's why when Bob and I together made our first call together, and he never really talked about money with the person. He just talked about their values, how they spent their life. And that's how I learned it. And I think that's the way development is done and how philanthropy is done and how people find, you know, the joy of philanthropy.
This concludes this portion of the interview with Martha Taylor addressing the issue of women and philanthropy. The overall oral history interview will continue on side one, tape 9. This is tape number 9, side 1 of the ongoing oral history interview with Martha Taylor, Vice President of the University of Wisconsin Foundation, June 22, 2006. Martha, if you would turn your focus now to the overall, some of the issues at the UW Foundation, what you've been doing lately, and your thoughts on the future of higher education at the university.
Very good. Well, we went through the end of the David Ward chancellorship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would be good to comment on, at this time, on the personalities of the different chancellors related mm-hmm. to development. I think Ed Young was a master. I mean, he loved to sit down with people and have conversations, and he was, you know, famous for that. He was glad to do that. Irv Sheen was the policymaker, and he'd make the speeches, and both Ed and Irv were great in making speeches. But Irv wasn't one to go out and make the visits to people so much. I think he had been the provost, and he was really more engrossed with running the institution, although he did go out on trips with us. But it was great that we were able, then after Ed stepped down from being president, that we were still able to use Ed in the role of going out with us.
Oh, he still worked with you?
Yeah, it was really nice. Oh. And he went with us on financial planning seminars and other things. And of course, he and Bob were good friends. And Ed is a good friend of everybody. Mm. Wonderful. Oh, he's just a great man. And he's good friends of Irv, too. So Irv trusted him. And you know, we all trusted each other. We were a tight team. And Tim Riley was always great and very good in using these people. And Jim Watrous, you know, these great personalities. And Tim was really such a hard worker in going out and visiting people. That's, mm-hmm. Oh, I've never seen anybody work so hard in visiting people. He was really the one that raised the big money for the foundation so far as going out and seeing people. Mm. And in those early days, I mean, he was the one to go out in those geographic areas. So, and it used Ed but Irv didn't want to do that. So then you get, you know, Donna. Donna was not one, again, to sit down and talk to people individually. She was not good at that. She would look over people's shoulders. Mm-hmm. She would not look them in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
Even at cocktail parties, you know, she'd shake your hand and be looking over it, seeing who's in the room. We'd get complaints from people. You know, Carlton Holstrom, he was a member of our board in New York. He would, you know, just kind of say, geez, you know, she just doesn't, you know, give you the time of day. But she was a great, you know, 5-minute speech maker.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she would rile up the troops. Donna never was a supporter of mine at all, and or women's philanthropy. She came to our Wingspread conference, but she did not value people who had been at the institution a long time. She was not a loyalist, you know. Glenn Watts left during that period. Glenn was one of the stars of the institution, and Glenn left. That was a big loss to our institution. He was a wonderful man. I've seen him. But she was good in media, and she was, you know, got a lot of national attention, which was good for us. But her great contribution was, of course, the athletic department. And that she got our athletic department to be first rate. And that did help our institution. It really did. I mean, we used to make jokes about it not affecting our fundraising. And I don't think it did in a way, but it helped our school spirit to have our athletic department doing a lot better. I think it did. And it didn't help our fundraising for academics because we still had to do our job out there. And the foundation, always our emphasis was on the academics. But it helped with school spirit, and I think it helped with legislative relations as well, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it helped with the average person in the state being proud of the institution. I think she understood that. So in terms of her contribution to the academic life of the institution, I think was poor. She hired very poor deans, but she did great things for the academic life, and she gave great fundraising speeches. So she was around and visible. Of course, I had known a lot of the deans, and I felt wonderful, great. We had great deans on board. Bollinger was a great dean. Bob Marshall was a great dean.
And they were at which school?
Engineering. That was engineering, mm-hmm. both of them. Of course, I knew Wendt before him. He had retired by that time, but Bob Marshall was dean. He had been, of course, a student of my grandfather's. But Bollinger was a terrific dean. We had had just, there were some great leaders on campus, Cronin. But there was some, Donna made some poor choices for deans. But as I said, Donna was great in making the great 5-minute fundraising speech, and that was very helpful.
Was it actually helpful?
Yeah.
Martha?
Oh, yeah, because she could go in and make a great, that's a great gift, you know, uh-huh. go in and make a good, quick fundraising speech mm-hmm. as a chancellor. That's helpful. Again, she wasn't good at the reception. She didn't make good one-on-one calls with anybody. So you couldn't take her out and go visit a major prospect or have, you know, one-on-one meetings with people. So when we got David Ward as chancellor, you know, he gave good speeches. They were longer, but he gave really good speeches. He was substantive. Donna didn't have the knowledge about the institution at all, mm-hmm. at all. She didn't have the academic background. I mean, she was a lightweight that way. But David, of course, he was the one running the institution. He knew what was going on. David had a temper sometimes in dealing with him on the road. But, you know, he had a lot of stress. You know, it's a hard job. But he was brilliant. And, he had good deans. He made good hires. He had John Wiley as provost, who's mm-hmm. a very, very good provost. David was high-strung, though I think that's his only fault I could give him. And, of course, he had Judith, who was wonderful in working at the Weissman Center, and wonderful hostess. And I think he was good one-on-one working with donors, that kind of thing. So I think we made really good progress working with David Ward.
Did you use David a lot on one-on-one visits?
Not as much he would. Yes, we did. We'd bring him, but more not. He wouldn't travel quite as much, but when it would come to town, we would. Mm-hmm. He'd visit the chancellor. But yes, we would.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And he was very good with that. He was very good. But they would have more, like, dinner parties and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very good at entertaining. And Judith, you know, spent a lot of time on that.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were a very good couple on that. But then we get John Wiley. And, of course, John, so far as the foundation is concerned, in recent years has been the easiest and most wonderful chancellor to work with. And of course then we did, the board did supplement his salary, so he is supposed to spend more time on fundraising, and mm-hmm. he does. But so far as easy going and, you know, not being fussy about things and, also not being hierarchical in that he will go and, you know, work with anybody and he'll drop in on, you know, the person that inputs the records in our, we have a little office for him at the foundation because. We pay him, so he has to go over there. And, you know, he'll go down the records person, or I'm kind of making this up as a story, but I mean, he'll, any person in the office, like if he has business with somebody, I mean, he won't, you know, give it.
Stand
to,
on ceremony.
Stand on, he'll just walk down to somebody's office and say, hi! Will you take care of this or whatever? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's not like I'm the chancellor, you know, will you, someone, my assistant will take care. You know, and he'll just drop by and, you know, be very casual. And,
uh-huh.
and is he's just very approachable and, you know, easy to get along with and you can talk to him. And that makes life so easy
mm-hmm.
for us. And so with his recent, these personnel problems, he's just, you know, it doesn't surprise me because, you know, he's just too easygoing sometimes, I think. And that got him into trouble a little bit, big trouble with this Barrow situation.
Paul Barrows.
Mm-hmm. Paul Barrows. Too easygoing, you see, and being too nice to his friend in administration. So, but he's been a wonderful person to visit donors one-on-one and also, and it is, he's actually paid to do that. And also, in speeches, he will give speeches, two good speeches. Sometimes he's not, you know, it's just like everybody, you're not 100% on, because he does get tired. But, you know, he's given brilliant talks. And just as David would always be on for speeches.
Mm-hmm.
Give brilliant talks, sometimes too long. But, always brilliant talks. And John has given some of the most brilliant talks I've heard.
And were John and David generally well received by alumni?
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah. And Irv gave brilliant talks too. He did. Yeah, Ed Young.
Martha, let me ask you, on the record, it was during John Wiley's tenure that the $20 million gift came from Jerry and Simona Chazen.
Yes.
And I know people had been working for decades with the
yes.
Chazens. Lots of people can claim credit. How do you assess the name change from the Elvia Museum to the Chazen Museum?
Well, I think the Chazens wanted it. I mean, Jerry in particular wanted the name change. And, you know, that was part of what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a real delicate situation.
Mm-hmm.
And very difficult. The only thing with that is, of course, the museum had found the Elvium name to be very, very difficult
mm-hmm.
nationally, because it is a very difficult name to pronounce.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we were kind of sympathetic with them on that. And since I don't use my husband's name because it's so difficult to pronounce, I'm very sympathetic with him. I use Martha Taylor instead of his name, which is Gary Antonowitz.
Mm-hmm.
But yet the Elvium is a beautiful Norwegian name, which means stream of the mountain. But, or mountain home, sorry, Hjemnes home. It's just unfortunate, but on the other hand, you see, the museum was named for Conrad Elvium because he died right at the time that it was being built. And
mm-hmm.
he was the one that was the president at the time of the vote of what was the priority need of the campus. And he was a scientist, and yes, he liked art, but if it had been some other interest, maybe they would have funded something else.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what I think, the building is still named the Elvium. It's just the museum complex is called Chazen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if the family, knowing the family, you know, and I talked to Dr. Richard Anderson yesterday, and he said, well, Connie, the wife who I knew as well, she was best friends with my grandmother, was interested in art, even if Conrad wasn't. Well, but knowing both of them, they would want the best thing for the university.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the best thing for the university.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is to get a $20 million gift that the university can expand. And knowing them, like I knew them, I knew Connie very well, they would really want this.
Mm-hmm.
They would think, go for this. This is no, forget it. It's not that important. I mean, they were never one for heirs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they would think this is great.
Well, I ask you because it will be a footnote to the history of the university with the infusion of major private money into a public university and some of the costs or requirements that go with that. So I was interested in your observations about it.
Yes, and it is, you know, and lots of people were upset by it who knew the Elvium, but of course the family, the son and so on, they gave their permission, I think knowing their parents.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think it's all right. Yeah, so I think that's an issue. Another issue I think I didn't cover before that I wanted to cover was what happened in the building of Granger Hall.
Uh-huh.
And that was under Irv Shane's watch. And I was busy with the constituency people and constituency offices. But what happened was I had heard the, I think Ann Benish was director of the Business School of Development at that time. And she had been keeping me informed that that the business alumni group had talked about going to the legislature to get money for a building. And I had said, you know, you really shouldn't be doing anything without talking to the chancellor. And, in fact, what had happened was the information she had received was old news. They already had. And so I told Bob and told Irv, and they, you know, found out. But it was really Joyce Erdman and a group, a lot of other people. And, of course, in they all are very proud of what they did. And so I don't want to throw cold water on the history of what they did. But it created havoc for the foundation.
Okay, lay that out, if you would.
Because what they did was they, an enthusiastic group of alumni, went directly to the legislature and said, to some key legislators and said, we, the business school alumni, will raise X amount of dollars. You know, we'll do it through the regular channels to the foundation. If the legislature gives X amount of money for the building. Okay. Now, they did not go through the Irv Shane's office to do that. And Irv would have said, no, you do not do that. What you do is you go to the legislature and you ask for the money up front and then you do fundraising on top of it. You don't leverage it. Because he was furious, furious. I just remember that. And I've never really seen him really quite so upset. And he said that this is going to create a precedent. They're going to do this forever. And I really honestly didn't really believe him. But of course, it did. Every single major building after that, the legislature has expected a private component. Every single major building after Granger. It created a precedent, just like Irv said. And it just upsets me to this day that they did that. And they're still touting it. See, and Joyce Erdman, who was a wonderful leader, and God bless her, did a great job in fundraising. But then what they did is, of course, they were very successful. You know, business school alumni have all the money in, like, not all, but a lot of the money in that our grads have. It's very easy for them to raise money for anything they want to because they've all done really, really well. So for them to go out and say they're going to raise this, it's fine. So they created this precedent that we have had to live with for buildings that we have no way that we are going to be able to raise a private component for.
Mm-hmm.
No way. Or we have a very small constituency.
Mm-hmm.
School of Human Ecology, you know, they give us this huge component of private giving that was almost impossible. This has been sitting here, you know. The School of Nursing, you know, this is something the state should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, buildings that really should be funded by the state.
Of course.
So this has created a really big problem. So I wanted to mention that and talk about the importance of, you know, following the protocol and that some of these things that were done were really important related to policies because of legislative relations. And then, of course, you see, you said to talk about the changes in higher ed and the changes in the funding.
Yes.
Is that with the budgets for prisons and the demands and then there's more conservative people going to the legislature saying this change in the mindset of the country, you know, saying that, why are we paying these taxes and this whole mindset, which I think is very unfortunate. This number one state that taxes are cut unnecessarily. People don't understand the taxes are good. And so in a speech I gave last August, I started to talk about, because here I am talking about philanthropy, the margin of excellence, always, forever in my speeches. So I challenged this group in this. We had a major conference on women's philanthropy last August, and which Sandra chaired again, and this was at the Center on Philanthropy, and we wrote a major paper, and our main thing was the future of women's philanthropy. That was my chapter in the book, too. Where should we be going from here? And so what I did is I challenged everyone.
We'll see.
So I challenged people to talk about the concept of the common good in whatever talk they were having on philanthropy and whatever message, because I think we talk so much about philanthropy that we have forgotten about. We have to have the taxes to provide the basics.
Of course.
And so if we don't have that, all the philanthropy in the world is not going to do it. And I think John Wiley has been giving that message.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Oh.
Philanthropy cannot replace
tax dollars.
Taxation.
No, it cannot. And so he's been giving that message in lots of his speeches.
Good.
And he's been very brilliant in that. And he actually, you know, because he's so good on numbers, he has the mathematical numbers of, you know, if everybody gave in this country this amount of money, would never replace this amount of money of this is the tax number and mm-hmm. all this. And he's very eloquent on this topic. And so, I mean, I just think that's the message is, hey, this has to stop. We need more tax money. We need more taxes. We need to pay more taxes in this country, folks, to support these institutions that are the undergirdings for our society, and higher ed is one of them. And where is this great hue and cry in our society? Okay, so that's kind of that's the message I've, told my son, so that's why he's moving to Washington, D.C. to go into politics. Maybe help us.
Mark
is? Yes.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, to me, it's like, all right, well, I went in philanthropy because I thought that would be the margin of excellence and help things. But, you know, we have the undergirding of our whole society slipping away. You know, philanthropy has to be on top of the foundation, which is our taxes. So we need to get back, you know, the next generation, meaning my son, has got to work on that. You know, I don't know what he's going to end up doing, but at least he's interested in that right now, and he's moving to Washington. So, you know, we really do need to work on building up our infrastructure again, because our great universities like Wisconsin cannot support itself on 16% state support. And also our tuition. We cannot have this tuition going up all the time. We have to have access for all our citizens. We can come up with some grand scholarship scheme. And some of the people in our office are saying, we need a grand scholarship donor to give us a pool of money and all this so we can provide monies for, you know, people above certain income levels and this kind of stuff. But no, we need state support. So I guess that's my soapbox on that. And we're going to really need to have some political action to change that. That's mm-hmm. I don't think there's any way of getting around it. And I can't do that in my position. Mm. My role is just to encourage people to be philanthropic. So,
but Martha, you must meet major donors who understand that. I mean,
yes.
Many of the major donors are sophisticated, intelligent people who see what's happening in society.
They are, but unfortunately there are some people on the foundation board who are some of the biggest supporters financially of some of the conservative people in our Wisconsin legislature who cut the budget. Mm-hmm. And John Wiley, in fact, got in trouble at one of the, not trouble, but some of the people I know didn't like it, when he criticized the legislature openly about cutting the university's budget.
Oh, in that letter in the alumni magazine.
Yes, he criticized the Wisconsin legislature for cutting the budget. And some of the biggest financial supporters of the conservative members of the legislature are on the financial foundation board. But, you know, I was sitting there in the at that dinner of the foundation board meeting, and I secretly was going, yes! John, you have the guts to say that in front of these foundation board members. Because what he said is, he said, you know, it's all great and well of that we can raise these wonderful dollars, but unless we have stronger state support, it's not going to, it's going to all go down the tubes. This university is going to go down the tubes. I mean, he had the guts to do it.
Good for John Wiley.
John Wiley has guts. I mean, John Wiley got up at a found the first foundation board meeting that I was ever at when he was chancellor. He said, see, that's why I don't get invited to some things anymore, because it's like, I'm too radical. It's like, that's not, I'm as radical as John Wiley. So, it's like, he got up at the board meeting and he said, you know, I think the last campaigns, we have all focused on the needs of business and engineering. And that is very important, and they are important to the university. But unless we focus on the College of Letters and Science, this university will never be good. You know, he said, that's the heart of the institution. And he said, we have got to maintain that college. I know. And because that's what we need. That's half of the university. And he had guts to say that. And, you know, here he is from the College of Engineering, and he had to say that. And that's what he said. And I do have to give salute to Paul Collins, the chair of our campaign, and Wade Fetzer. They are both business school graduates. Where did they give their money? Paul Collins, music. Mm-hmm. Yay, Paul. Wade Fetzer gave it to minority programs, another program of the chancellor's priorities. Yay, Wade. See, those guys listened. They did it. They did it by example. And so more money has come in for letters and science. And now I hope we can do this East Campus Mall, which is Wiley's vision. And I hope we, you know, I want to spend time on this. This is what I want to spend my time on, is, you know, with Walt Keough and my other colleagues. And now Letters and Science is going to be under Marion Brown. And, you know, Marion and Walt have asked me to work more on this area, work with music and help, because we've only got a couple of years that John's going to be chancellor.
Right.
And this is his dream, was is the East Campus Mall, really to have an arts corridor where we have a performing arts center, to get the Chazen built, to really make that a fantastic area for the university. And we have a chancellor willing to spend time on it. And we need to staff it. We haven't staffed it. We have not staffed it. We've been weak. I mentioned, you know, a long time ago in this interview that in 1980, when we set up this constituency fundraising program, that, you know, I thought we would, the companion piece to that was going to be the vision for what we did for the chancellor's office, for the central campus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what kind of a program were we going to have? We were going to call it something special. We never did that. You know, we've never staffed what is the central campus's fundraising. Are we calling it the enterprise fund? Are we, whatever. So we're getting close to that now, because we're putting all this energy now on East Campus Mall, which is Wiley's vision. And it's a great vision, and it's exciting. So I see that as something we got to accomplish in the next couple of years. And we're coming out of the campaign the Create the Future campaign, and it was like, I don't know, $1.5 billion in county, and it's, you know, play money, it's so big.
Mm-hmm.
And our endowment is something like $2.2 billion and rising, and our staff is 130 now compared to 9 when I started there. So...
I have more blank tapes.
No.
This is side 2, tape 9, Martha Taylor.
Just the senior leadership team of the foundation now is John Gray, Mark Lefebvre, Karen Crosley, Walt Keel, Miriam Brown, Chris Richards, Lynn Johnson, Sandy Wilcox, Jennifer DeCray, and Bonnie Schumacher. And these people, we... I'm pleased to be on the senior leadership team. Again, I think that's been about the last 8-9 years again. So I've been on the senior leadership team again. I asked Sandy if I could join that group. I think once Tim left. That's once Tim retired. And the politics were right. That's worked out, and so intellectually,
has that been reasonably cordial at this point, Martha?
Yes, and of course intellectually then I've been very much more fully engaged in the foundation's activities as a result, and mm-hmm. that's what I wanted. But you see, when I was really on the road with women's philanthropy for all really 10 years, you know, nationally, almost. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
10 years. That I wasn't on the senior leadership team at that time. And I couldn't. I was building the Women's Philanthropy Institute, and I still was doing a lot of work, obviously Bascom Hill Society and other activities at the foundation, and I had a full load of prospects that I was working with, the foundation, mm-hmm. Women's Philanthropy Council. But then when I looked to staying closer to home with teenagers, and also Miriam Brown talked to me about joining a senior leadership team and things that needed to be done that she needed my help on. So that's been the last few years, and I've worked in a number of different projects with them, mm-hmm. and done things. And so during the campaign, I worked again on the faculty staff campaign. It's an old theme that I've worked on, but I really do enjoy working with the faculty on their giving.
And it was extremely successful, was it not, Martha?
It was very successful.
I mean, you raised tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah, something like $44 million.
Yeah, I think Marion Brown told me that it was the single most successful component of the...
I don't know about that.
Something... She was very complimentary, and she said it was tens of millions of dollars.
It was. It was like $44 million. The faculty and emeritus faculty and the staff of this university are the most single, generous group of people as an audience. If you pick any audience... You know, if you take 100 people, you know, 100 alumni, 100, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. they are the most generous group of people. So it's like, it's easy. They know the university. They love the university. And especially as they get older. And everyone thinks they don't have any money. Well, they do, because they've lived frugally. They have not had to have high lifestyles. Most of them, you know, like a lot of our alumni in their jobs, you know, they have to join different clubs just because of business. You know, they have to look like they have money or something.
Mm-hmm.
Our faculty and staff don't have to do that. They can show up to work in, you know, more casual clothes. They don't need to drive a fancy car or have mm-hmm. any of these things. So, and they live frugally. So... A lot of faculty have accumulated assets, and they're extremely, more than anything, extremely dedicated to the university. So it has been my privilege to get to know them and working with them on their gifts, their ultimate gifts to their department. And then I get to do as you do, work with them and hear about their lives, mm-hmm. and what they've done, what they've accomplished. And I've worked with people such as Leon Epstein and Crawford Young, and wonderful, wonderful people. I want to mention Betty Hirschfelter and Joe Hirschfelter.
Oh, sure.
And they gave wonderful gifts to the chemistry department in theoretical chemistry, and they are actually friends of my grandparents. But Betty was a wonderful woman to work with and an inspiration in being an early math professor here. And then, of course, when she married Joe, she was told she couldn't teach anymore. So,
mm-hmm.
But she was very instrumental in keeping up relationships with Joe's students over many years and helping Joe edit his books and so on. But Bird, another person that I really must mention, who has been a mentor that Bob Renabom told me to go visit when I started at the foundation, emeritus faculty Clara Penniman.
Mm.
And Clara in political science was a wonderful mentor, quiet mentor in encouraging women's leadership. But, oh, she always encouraged me, and she encouraged me to come over and see her periodically. Not only did I work with her on her giving, but over the years, but she's my friend, and what a gift. And she's also Gina Shapiro's friend, Professor Gina Shapiro's friend and mentor, and she took Gina under her.
Oh, did she?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so Gina and I have Clara in common, and we had a wonderful dinner with Clara and Gina and her husband, Graham Wilson, now chair of political science, last fall, with a student named Terry Lehrman, who had given an award in honor of Clara.
Oh.
An award fund. And
is Clara still alive?
Yes, she's 91 now. Yeah, she lives at Oakwood, so I have to go see her. I was thinking about that. But these wonderful faculty members who are so generous to the university, just incredible. So that's always been a true delight in working on those campaigns with the faculty and organizing the campaigns. And I think, of course, the current people in office are always worried about it and thinking no one's going to give. And you have to calm them down and then you have to deal with all the, all the negative things, and you calm them down. Really, people are going to give, and confidence. And it's great. It's wonderful. And then you get to meet the current faculty as well. So I've always liked that assignment. And I have a team at the foundation. It's, in a way, I don't have people I supervise, but I really do. I have the best of all worlds right now in that I have people assigned to work with me on this group, but I don't have to day-to-day supervise them.
Mm-hmm.
So we meet once a month, and then, they're assigned tasks, and we do different things. So. And I get to pick, new people, and it's really fun, getting acquainted with these new foundation staff people. And I have a fun time with that group of people. We have a nice working relationship. So that's been a lot of fun. So I think that's a good statement about our faculty, though, faculty and staff, and this institution. But another thing that we need to look at as the foundation is how are we covering our cross-disciplinary programs. We haven't done a good job at that, and as the university kind of tries to get out of the department mode and looks at like international studies,
mm-hmm.
where you don't have particularly alumni of that department, how do you raise money for international studies? It's like more like raising money for a nonprofit, because you have to identify the constituency out of this big pool of people. It's not like you're a grad of this particular department, so let's just invite you to something. So it's raising money for a nonprofit is much more difficult than raising money for a higher ed institution, because mm-hmm. with a higher ed institution, you have a built-in constituency.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more difficult, and raising money for these cross-disciplinary programs, and we have to do a better job at that. As our university looks at doing those things, we need to raise money for, you know, oral history or different things outside of departments.
Mm-hmm.
So we,
all the cross-cultural area studies, Hispanic or Afro-American or
yeah.
Jewish or gay and lesbian or yeah. whatever, all of those.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And I think that the current leadership of the foundation we're in good shape. We're going to be looking at a lot of retirements within the next 5 years. But, you know, I'll be there for the next 10 years. Some of us will be there for the next 10 years. But Sandy will probably be retiring. He definitely within the next 5 years. So we'll be having turnover and change is inevitable.
Martha, who's the leadership of the foundation board of directors now? And who's coming along?
Well, John Oros is the current chair, and he's a very good person. And we have some younger people who I think will be good leaders. I wish Guy Godchop would be chair. He's off for a year now. I think he'll be coming back to be leaders. We've got some younger people who are on the investment committee that will be good leaders for the future. We have and I just think that these new women leaders like Orbison, McPherson, these women are going to be remembered who are current leaders on the foundation board,
uh-huh.
Who are coming up, Manley, Weisberg, Huffman. These uh-huh. are the women leaders who are currently on the foundation board who will be coming up and I hope will take on more leadership roles mm-hmm. in the future. So I'm optimistic about that. Well, I just wanted to close my comments that with the philosophy of the foundation that I think we try to mirror the university, and that we've always respected the university. The only reason the foundation has been as successful as it has been, and sometimes I think, in spite of all the faults of the foundation, the only reason we've done well is because of the university, that the university is a great institution.
Mm-hmm.
And the university is one of the best in the world. And not only is it great because it produces wonderful graduates, has wonderful faculty, because of the Wisconsin idea, and that it applies the knowledge truly to the state and to the world. And it was my privilege to be part of that and continue to be part of that through my work in women's philanthropy, and that someday maybe I will be able to write something on the contribution of the University of Wisconsin to the women's philanthropy movement in terms of having the Women's Philanthropy Institute at the School of Human Ecology and at the foundation, not only just of my work, but many others, Andrew Kaminsky and the deans and supporting it, Sandra Shaw, and also the time that she spent at the State Historical Society let her work on it. I mean, that was part of the Wisconsin tradition of that we're supposed to do this kind of thing. We're supposed to apply what we know to help others in society, to help other educational institutions, and to help others just to make a better society. And so I think that's something that makes our institution great that I don't know that our legislature today appreciates that. I do think our students appreciate that. I do think they know that. I was so thrilled that when my, I have two nieces here at the university that I helped recruit.
And oh, really?
Yeah, I'm so thrilled. They're really doing well, too. And one of them who came, who I recruited from Berkeley, actually, which I'm thrilled. So she's the fourth generation of our family. Of course, our two boys wanted to go elsewhere, and that's normal.
Of course.
Yes. But my niece that I recruited, one that is from Minneapolis, she's now going to be a junior. And now I've got a sophomore. She's from Berkeley, my Berkeley one. So came here. And she knew all about the Wisconsin idea before she came because she had read about it. She knew about it from high school. They had learned about it. And I said, my gosh, that's really amazing. That made me so proud to know that. That's terrific. And that's what should be. Mm-hmm. That's the way it should be. That the Wisconsin idea should be known that way. But that's what makes our university great. And then, of course, our research that we do and our teaching that has affected so many lives of students. And then that makes the foundation job easier because we talk to alumni whose lives have been affected by these great teachers and by the great experience they had with other colleagues and the school spirit and the wonderful atmosphere here. And the party atmosphere is great. I think it's terrific. I mean, it adds, makes the fun experience.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's terrific. So, we are only good because our institution is good, and we always must remember that. And I never, you never can get egotistical at the foundation that we do well. I never have been egotistical
mm-hmm.
at the foundation. I know some people at the foundation are egotistical about it.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Rinnebaum was never egotistical about it. He always knew that the reason we got in a lot of money was because of the university.
Absolutely.
Certain people now at the foundation are egotistical about it. You cannot be egotistical about it. So I think that's a very important thing to know. Is we are only as good as our institution. Therefore, we must do well because the university needs us to do well, however. So our values are important, and the way we do our business must reflect the institution. And so we must operate with integrity, and we also have to have this philosophy that I believe now we have cemented into the value statement, which I really do have to salute Sandy that he had, Sandy Wilcox, that he had us go through the process of self-evaluation, which was very critical of him, and that he made some adjustments in his behavior and so far as more top-down. He's changed since that self-evaluation. The board made him go through it, but this was about 5 or 6 years ago. You see, things have changed. And we came up with a value statement for the foundation at that time, and it was very much, it just was as if the words had come out of Bob Rinnebaum's mouth. But they came out of all of our mouths together, all of us, meaning the senior leadership team that went through the planning process. And what is the foundation value statement? But it talks about doing business with integrity, with honesty, and then it, but it really talks and reflects our value of the relationship building development. That we are in it for the long term with our donors, mm-hmm. and that we value stewardship of the money very highly and reporting to the donors on the use of their money and on the restrictions of their gifts is very important to us. And that has always been emphasized. It was something Bob emphasized, John Felt emphasized, and that will continue. And that's really something that we've done very, very well. So I think that those values are the things that will make the foundation continue to be successful in the future. Sticking to our values and recruiting board members that respect those values, that let the staff do what we do best and not mucky around mm-hmm. with a day-to-day, and Sandy's been good in making sure they don't monkey around, because I think that's important. But yet engaging the board is very important, because they're powerful leaders and they need to be engaged, because they're some of our biggest donors and they're very helpful to us. But having a vision of the day-to-day is important, but really, where is the message, the exciting message of what the foundation is doing, has always got to be attached to the message of the university. What is the future of the university? And because we are the servant of the university. What do you think?
This concludes the interview with Martha Taylor, and let the record reflect that not only is Martha Taylor gifted and productive, she is a worthy successor to her grandfather. Thank you, Martha.
I'm glad.